We snuck up on you dirty bitches. It's only 12:15 here on the East Coast or the West Coast. If we were on the East Coast, this would be like the normal starting time. This is like the East Coast version of the fucking podcast. People say, hey, Joe Rogan, how the fuck do you guys, do you make any money off of this podcast? How's that work? I'll tell you one way it works, bitches. It's a little thing called DeathSquad.tv. Check that shit out. See that t-shirt? You could go buy that. You could buy that high-quality Brian Redband-designed work of art. And you could have it, and you could walk around with it. Every show we go to, mad Death Squad fans in the audience, this is where the shirts come from. Go to DeathSquad.tv. There's two versions of them. This is the newest version, and with the sexiest cat, in my opinion. I like this cat better. This is the dopest cat. And there will be more. And there's t-shirts, and there's bumper stickers. And what is the new website?
ShopSquad.tv.
ShopSquad.tv. But DeathSquad.tv will take you there. So if you can't remember that, because I can't remember that, he's already told me twice, go to DeathSquad. DeathSquad.tv. You got it? All right, you fucking freaks. Onnit.com is our other sponsor. And periodically, ladies and gentlemen, let me just say one thing. We've had a few other sponsors, some corporate sponsors, people like Audible.com, people like Ting.com, Alienware. The reason why if we're in business with any company, it's because they got something good for you. You will never, we have turned down stuff that's like high profile sponsors that I don't agree with. I don't like what they're selling. I don't want to say what they want me to say. I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in, I think there's plenty of people out there like Ting, the mobile company that has Ting, no cell phone contracts and excellent phones. I really love this Samsung Galaxy S3. It's fucking gorgeous. I'm really gonna have a hard time going back to the iPhone. It's such a little puny screen.
I think I'm going the other way since Apple screwed me with my pre-order. I think I'm just gonna go not get this new iPhone and just go Galaxy S3.
You should. We're gonna hook it up with Ting. Ting, you know they weren't even supposed to be sponsored on this podcast today, but we're bringing them up. Just because that's our entire approach to advertising on this podcast. Anything that we're involved with is something that we believe is a great product. With Alienware, the thing that I really love about Alienware is how much love they give to up-and-coming MMA fighters. Everywhere I look, on Strikeforce, on Bellator, on UFC, there's constantly dudes with that Alienware logo. That means to me that a company is putting their money behind a sport. And when a company is like Alienware that's owned by Dell, this huge computer company, I mean, that to me is a bold, it's a bold chance by them. And I think bold moves like that should be supported. And that's why we use Alienware computers. Onnit.com is another sponsor. It's the only one that I have a financial investment in. And again, the only reason why I would do that is because I wholeheartedly believe in the way the company operates and in what they're selling. The big product that I'm always pushing is Alpha Brain. And you don't need Alpha Brain. I've said this a million times before, but I always have to say, in case this is the first time someone has ever tuned into this podcast, if you eat healthy and you're in fit, you probably don't need it. It's not a necessary part of your life. But they are nutrients that have been shown to enhance your brain's ability to produce neurotransmitters, to fire thoughts off. And from a person that knows the difference between the way I feel when I'm eating healthy, when I'm eating nutritious food, and when I'm supplementing my diet, and when I'm not doing that, there's a difference. I feel a tangible difference. I feel a difference in my performances, the way I'm able to form sentences, the way I can come up with ideas quicker. I mean, I really believe in that. It's shit's all fired together in there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to lie to you. I might have smoked a little pot before this. just a wee bit, and I might be a little long-winded. What I'm saying is Onnit.com's got some cool shit that I support 100%. The first order of 30 pills, there's a 100% money-back guarantee. You all right, buddy?
I think
you're not supposed
actually
to snort it. No, he did. It's because the tube was way too big. It couldn't be real. Look how long his tube was. If he did do it, I don't think you should snort it. I don't think it's supposed to go through your digestive tract. It's food. We also have kettlebells and battle ropes. We're starting to sell fitness equipment now. And again, it's all stuff that I use, stuff that I think is some of the best strength and fitness conditioning equipment that you can get. It's kettlebells. It's a fucking fantastic workout. Use the code name Rogan and you will save yourself 10% off all supplements. And again, with the supplements, you have a 30-pill. The first 30 pills is a 100% money-back guarantee. You don't even have to return the product. Just say it sucks. No one's trying to rip you off. Everyone's trying to sell you the best shit possible and stuff that I would use. All right, that's it. Go to onnit.com, O-N-N-I-T. And Brian, anything more to say? Oh, yeah, Death Squad show tonight. We're at the Ice House tonight. It is, Tom Segura is out. Ari Shaffir is in. That's how we roll.
Shit.
We got Ari Shaffir. We got Joey Diaz. We got Dom motherfucking Irera. We got Greg Fitzsimmons in the house, bitches. And Doug Benson. And Brian Redband, did I say you?
No,
you're in there too, bitch. And me, yeah, I'll be there too. It's gonna be awesome.
Icehousecomedy.com.
Yeah, we do these on a regular basis here. And there's another one here. I'm in Toronto on Friday night at Massey Hall. That shit sold out, son. But if you want tickets to a comedy show in your LA, you can come to the Ice House.
Yeah,
show here.
Death Squad show Friday.
All right, bitches. Mac Danzig's here. We're gonna get it done properly. We forgot to do the piano.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
This is way better. Mac Danzig is, I think you might be podcast haunted, my friend.
Yes. No. We're going to fix it this time.
Yeah, we're going to fix it. We're going to get this done. See, you demand a proper setup. That's what it is. The fucking setup at my house is ridiculous. Little goddamn stupid webcams. That's why. I have a studio, but that's in the process of being put together. That shit's going to take months, yo. Somebody said I should make a little video of where, you know, show like what it looks like in the beginning. Yeah, I might do that.
Time-lapse it. Just set one in the corner and...
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I've never done anything like this before, so it's kind of exciting to build something up. But Mac Danzig, my humblest apologies on my
no problem,
retardation man. And my technical abilities. Mine and Ari Shaffir's. Ari did a podcast with him.
See if I
we had a good conversation. It wasn't on video or whatever. He does podcast audio, but yeah, we had a really good conversation. And it was afterwards. I was like, oh man, I think he was more disappointed about it even than I was. I mean, he felt pretty bad about it. And it's just, there's nothing you can do. And I was like, you really emptied the trash too. You didn't just delete it, but you emptied it. And he's like, yeah. Well, I had to make more room. And
oh,
I'm just thinking,
God, get a new laptop, bitch.
No. We had a great little conversation.
Yeah, well, there's 40 minutes that, you know, we may or may not put back on, but what happened with us was the second file was corrupt. It wasn't
when we
working.
Started over.
Yeah, it wasn't working on Ustream, and the MP3 recorder went off, and then I had to turn it back on again. Remember, Brian, I had to take the battery off,
mm-hmm.
and the file afterwards was corrupt.
Yeah.
Wacky ass.
And Ustream
shit.
Didn't work. It was that's crazy that they both.
Haunted as fuck. Yeah, that was a big goddamn disaster, but we're going
to
correct that
shit.
So
you think you're going to add the 40 minutes to this one when you put it on iTunes?
We could do
no?
that. We can make this the well, I just hope we don't get redundant.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is when you have a conversation like that, you know, like there's a lot of shit that we said that I want to make sure we cover.
Right.
So
right.
Fuck that other podcast.
Okay,
let's
cool.
Ghost that bitch.
Yeah, all right. That's what's
unless,
up.
Unless we want to send someone back into the archives to edit it. I don't know, man. A lot of internet drama, man. If you've been paying attention to this this crazy video that all these Muslims are responding to all over the world, this ridiculous.
You told me about it last week. Yeah, the Christian fundamentalist video. Yeah.
Have you been watching all the reaction to it?
I haven't. No.
Well, France, in their infinite wisdom, someone has decided today to publish a cartoon with Muhammad in it.
No.
Like they're just pushing it. Like
we're gay.
Yeah, we're going to be crazy. How do they smoke cigarettes? Is it like this? We're going to be crazy.
Look, Muhammad make a fart noise with his face.
Yeah, there's something about the way they hold cigarettes that was really annoying, right? How's it like this? Is it this?
Well, they call them fags
over
there.
Yeah, that might be. Yeah.
There's something to it. Was it this? Is it this? There's something. There's something wrong.
Yeah,
it's like, hey, fuckface. This, you know, this is the way to do it. This is the right way to do it. You have full use of your hands. What's all this crazy shit?
It's like the tea thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we do it. Smoke it like this. Oh! Eek, 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 eek. I just got another text from Dice Clay telling me how awesome his special came out. He's so fucking psyched. Dice Clay said he did his special, and he said it was like the old days. He said dudes were standing up and screaming. He said there was a mad Death Squad fans in the crowd, too. That he had a bunch of guys coming up to him that said they heard him from the podcast. Nice. Yeah, he said it was like one of his best specials ever. So that's the only cool time you're allowed to hold a cigarette like this.
That just reminds me of, you know, the people that I got the tea or the coffee or whatever. It actually reminds me of one of my favorite scenes, Mulholland Drive. Are you familiar with?
Yeah, you're a Lynch fan, right?
Yeah,
you're
David Lynch fan? Huge Lynch fan. Yeah, and he's holding the coffee. He's like napkin. He requests a napkin first. And he sips it, sets it down, then spits it out into the napkin. And like, my God, this is the finest espresso in the world. Like, it was that's what's up, man. That's funny stuff, man. David Lynch is like.
He's so weird, isn't he?
Yeah.
His movies are so, like, sometimes you leave and you go, what did you just do to me, you fuck?
I know. I trusted you.
It's like the
ability to express emotions, you know, through film. The ability to make the viewer, to evoke emotion in the viewer is strange emotions that are very peculiar. Like, nothing that really you can put your finger on, at least I can't, as far as articulating it, like with language. It's just one of those things you got to watch.
Yeah,
you feel creepy, you feel a little bit, you know, like it's a little,
it's cold and wet.
But there's humor involved in it too, like a sort of a dark humor. It's really cool. He's able to play with ideas and notions and just, you know, purvey them with film. That's pretty.
I've really enjoyed some of his stuff, but I've walked out of a few of his things going, what the fuck was that?
Did you walk out of Inland Empire like that?
No, that Inland Empire one. Was that wasn't that bad. I liked that one.
Yeah.
Who's the stars of Inland Empire?
That's gonna be Laura Dern.
Yeah.
And what's his name? The same guy that played in Mulholland Drive.
See, I thought Mulholland Drive, I thought the end of it was just too fucked up. I was just like, wait a minute, what? This is it? It just ends right here?
But that's the whole thing is I don't, the way I look at his films, I don't think that they're always necessarily a plot or a story to figure out. It's just
an experience.
Yeah, an experience. And you can take it for what it's worth. Yeah. And there's all sorts of theories as to, you know, what was really happening in the story and everything. And there's one major one that everyone adheres to as far as Mulholland Drive goes. But I think it's like, man, it's just the experience. I don't even try to figure it out. It's like a psychedelic experience. It's like you can't force yourself back into the here and now, like regular reality, and try to, you know, figure everything out while it's happening. Right. It's just, you just have to
just gotta go with it.
Yeah. Yeah, submit yourself to it.
Give into the
experience.
Lynch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember Blue Velvet. Was it Dennis Hopper? We had mm-hmm. the mask.
Yeah,
he kept puffing.
Yeah,
and he was just intense. And I remember
only he could pull that.
Oh God, it was so intense. It was so like, oh my God, like that guy. Dennis Hopper, for sure, has seen some real life insanity. There's no way he could be that intense about some shit unless he's seen something, man.
Yeah.
You ain't pulling that out of your ass. That shit was too real. that Blue Velvet huffing character.
Yeah, man. That was one of the greatest scenes ever, man.
Yeah,
sure.
Lynch had just done such bizarre stuff. But that's how it would make you feel, like almost creepy.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. If you watch, I have a DVD that has some of, it's called, I think it's called The Lost Films of David Lynch, and it has some of the things that he was doing when he was in college and when he was coming up, like his first, like some animation stuff, and some of it's pretty disturbing, and then some of it is like, wow, like this is, you know, like borderline genius stuff, at least, you know, from a creative standpoint. It's pretty cool.
Oliver Stone's lost his fucking mind.
Yeah.
This movie tried to put out where these two dudes are living with this one chick and they're both banging her and there's no problems. Oliver, fuck you.
Yeah, man.
Fuck you, silly. That movie's more ridiculous than the Avengers.
Yeah. I'm cool with Oliver Stone. I don't think he sucks. You can't say anything like that. But, I don't know.
Platoon?
Yeah.
He's fucking brilliant.
Yeah,
Oliver Stone. Yeah. Wall Street? Oliver Stone's brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm not going to see your drug war movie about the noble drug dealers who are both in love with the girl. Fuck you. That is just so ridden with cliches. It's like, how much coke were you on when you came up with that idea?
I often think back and almost wish that Tarantino would have followed through with his script and done Natural Born Killers himself, because I really would have loved to see what his take on it was.
I loved Oliver Stone's take on it.
I did too.
But there's been two movies like that where Tarantino said that he didn't really enjoy the finished product. It wasn't really like what it was. That was that and the Christian Slater movie.
True Romance,
yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, exactly.
Which was
fucking
brilliant movie. How you could complain about anything about True Romance?
Like, well, you know,
God damn, that was a good movie.
When you have a baby, you know what I mean. Like, if you were to write a stand up routine and then have somebody else doing it, even if they hit it out of the park, it'd be like, well, that's not the way I wanted.
Dude, I would be the worst writer for somebody. I'd be terrible about that. But yeah, but True Romance, the movie, the finished product was a fucking work of art.
Yeah.
That's one of the all-time best, like, troubled romance,
man.
You know, fight for each other to the death.
Yeah.
Whew.
Absolutely.
That's a lot of positivity in that movie, man. There's
perfection.
It's perfection in the imperfections of life.
Yeah.
That's a badass fucking movie.
Patricia Arquette.
Christian Slater was a bad motherfucker in that movie. What happened to that dude? How does that happen where a dude does like a True Romance? You would figure he'd be in movies constantly. If he can do that, what he did in that movie?
What, did he do Cuffs before or after that?
Cuffs?
Yeah, remember that with a K? It was just like one of his... Like,
a dog movie? Was it a dog movie?
No. It was just like a silly comedy where he was like a cop or something, like an undercover cop or something like that. It was just one of those things that... Like, actors, they got to work and everything,
right.
And I understand that. And so that was just one of the things where it's like, well, like, you're kind of starting to take a path on a, you know, kind of corny direction. You know what I mean? Like, I watch guys do that all the time who are great actors, and they are able to repair it by picking and choosing the projects that they want to work on, and then they redeem themselves every time. But he was kind of – I think that was when I was starting to kind of look at him funny, you know?
Well – I looked at the whole world funny once Ice Cube started doing family comedies. I was like, what the fuck is going on?
Have you ever seen that picture online? It's the first picture, it's you know, one of those, the internet pictures, where they took a photograph of him. I think he has an AK-47. He's sitting there with B-Real from Cypress Hill. And,
bandana on, frowning on his fuck.
Yeah, and it says, at first I was all like, .. And then at the bottom it shows him with like a fishing pole, like on a vest. Like, with a
big Rolex.
Yeah, he's got like he's like out on a boat or something. He's got a life vest on, like a big life vest all the way up to his neck. And he's like smiling all goofy. And it's like, but then I was all like. Yeah,
it's weird seeing him in those beer commercials. You know, look, I can't talk shit about people selling out. I did Fear Factor, you know, and I did it twice. I took some time off and went back and did it again. So I can't talk shit about it. If you got to make your money, you got to make your money. But for us, it's very odd to see. I mean,
that's
I'm not
it.
Criticizing.
That's it.
Oh my God, that's so hilarious. Oh, I love these fucking things. Internet memes, man, make me laugh so hard.
I spent like 4 hours the other weekend on knowyourmeme.com. You ever seen that website? It's like I think that's what it's called, knowyourmeme.com, and it's like this site that documents pretty thoroughly all these different internet memes, from Techno Viking to that Jesse Slaughter girl. Do you remember her?
Jesse Slaughter.
It's sad in a way. It's fucked up. I mean, she's like some 11 or 13 year old girl who got like all into gossip and some little scene or subculture of music and everything. And you know how
is she the Friday girl? Friday.
No. This is some girl where like what happened was she became so popular in this little subculture and everybody just jumped on her and was like ridiculing her and all this stuff because she was going around saying that she was sleeping with all these dumb emo artist and everything in some rock band, and you know she's like a little kid and she was doing all these webcam things. You know how it's popular now with YouTube where everybody just sits in front of their computer with like their like clothes hanging from the doorknob in the background. They're like, you know, like talking about whatever, giving a review on a movie or talking about whatever, and she was doing all that stuff and getting really like scandalous with it, and so people just were just tearing her apart. And her dad got on like a live webcam broadcast. It was like,
is that the one, Brian, that you did?
Yeah, with Lil Esther.
Brian did a like a parody of that.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of people did. Yeah, and he's he's like, he's totally talking out of his ass. He's like, I'm talking to the cyber police, and I've backtraced all of the emails. And if you know, if you ever come near my daughter, talk about her. He was his big quote. He goes, consequences will never be the same again, or something like that. It was sad. People screw up their lives on the internet. Oh yeah, here's a parody of it.
Yeah, that's Brian. That's Brian.
And little Esther. We're gonna get all of you.
Brian, we got to see the real one first. Yeah. We got to see the real one first, so we can know how silly yours is.
Yeah, it's
the
it's
the,
sad.
Well, honestly, you know what you're also seeing in that video? You're seeing a guy who's not aware of the playing field.
Yeah, no, totally. That's why it's so interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating because there's a guy who doesn't understand that you just put something out there in the internet, virally. Like, you don't really know what that is, do you? Like, that's going to hit millions of people. Like, the idea never crossed his mind that he would be able to yell something into a video camera and then it would become like a meme and people would do parodies of it.
Yeah, he thought he was just talking to a select group of people who were like tormenting his kid or whatever. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. That's still you fuck.
Yeah.
Trying to trick me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was. It's weird to see like viral videos. Yeah. You know, like everybody knows about the Goatsy guy. You know, the guy who pulled his asshole apart, and it's particularly disturbing because in the photo he's wearing a wedding ring. He's like tugging his asshole open.
Can you imagine if we know this guy, the original guy? Can you imagine if it's just somebody that we know and he's like very ashamed of that photo and he's just like a normal guy? It's like, look, I was just really drunk.
Yeah, you could be. But the thing is, the way he's clawing at it, it's like this guy's done that before. I mean, he's just clawing open his asshole. The way he's doing it just doesn't seem. You know what, for a second there, when I said clawing open his asshole and you reach for the board, I was like, oh, I swore. You know why? Because I had to do radio this morning.
I'm about to close my eyes if you put that shit up.
No, you can't put that up. You can't see that. You know, the people at home, they don't deserve Goatsy.
Oh,
no,
man.
But I had to do regular radio today.
Oh, that sucks.
It doesn't suck. I mean, they were real nice. But I forgot, like, how rarely I do that now. So when I do it, I always have to go, don't swear. Like, I'm not a professional anymore. Like, at any second, something come out of my mouth.
You're a professional. You're just not censoring yourself with these ridiculous censorship ideas.
It's just, to me, it was strange being aware of it and thinking for a second. And then thinking, this is like the reality of most people's lives that are on radio. Everybody's under the gun. You got to be real careful what the fuck you say.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't done radio in a while. When I had like my little 15 minutes of fame right after the Ultimate Fighter show, I was doing a whole lot of radio shows and... You know,
for those of you who don't know, Mac Danzig won the Ultimate Fighter in season
6.
Was about 5 years ago?
It completed in, what was that, 2008, I think? Or
4 years ago?
Yeah, 2007. Yeah, I think it was 2008. Yeah, it was like right when it completed. 2007, 2008.
You're an alumni. That's a very prestigious group of humans.
Yeah. Right.
Guys who have won the Ultimate Fighter?
Well, yeah, I guess so. You know what I mean? It was definitely an experience.
It's a huge accomplishment. It's not just like winning a fight. They're just getting through the experience. I mean, I watched the tapes. I've seen, I've talked to dudes about what it's like. It's it's hellacious.
Yeah. I mean, I knew what I was getting into when I did it, so... My whole idea heading into that show was just to win. Like, there's this guy, I don't know if you know who he is. He doesn't really do jiu-jitsu anymore, but he was one of the guys that I first started training with in Los Angeles when I first moved out here. His name is Fernando Vasconcelos. Probably, he won the worlds in jiu-jitsu as a black belt when he was 16. He's one of, in the gym, one of the best prodigies in the world. Like, I mean, I've never rolled with anybody anywhere near as good as him. Like,
really?
Honestly. Like, I mean, maybe like Robert Drysdale is like, you know, has that same type of ability, but Robert's also way bigger than me. But Fernando was just amazing. And I remember one of the things, you know, he had already kind of given up on fighting and everything. And he told me before I left, he's like, just remember, just do this to win. You're there to win. You're not there to goof off And like, you know, you can do whatever you want, but the goal is to win the show so that you can have a career and, you know, better yourself and keep moving forward. And I was on there, as soon as I got in, there was all these guys. Half of them were like deer caught in the headlights. They were just like, oh man, like I'm actually on the show and what's going to happen? Are they going to surprise us or, you know, what's going to go on? And then the other half of the guys were just there to be goofballs, hoping that they get enough exposure to, you know, put some pictures up on their MySpace page or get laid or whatever they wanted to do. And I was, that's why everybody's like, oh, you're so grumpy and you're so angry and everything. It's like, well, dude, I'm trying to win this. This is what I'm doing. Like, I'm very serious about this.
Do you find that that's a weird position where a lot of fighters find themselves, where they have to also try to be a showman? They have to, like, you see the encouragement that people get from sure. trash talking because it sells pay-per-views.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, my whole thing is the whole reason why I'm doing this, and maybe I didn't know it when I first got into it, but now after looking back of years of a career, like over 10 years I've been doing this, and reflecting, it's like I picked this because, one, it's artistic, two, it's fighting, and I just like the fight, and three, it's honesty. It's about being authentic, and that's from the beginning to the end for me. So, like, you know, like the marketing of the fight, the preparation of the fight, and the actual act, the art of doing it live in a spontaneous way. And I do it because it's about being honest with yourself. There's, once you get in there, there's no script, there's no faking it. That's what's going to happen. And I love that. I love putting myself out there, and, like, you know, it's the ultimate sacrifice, it's ultimate commitment. And so when you start to, like, fake beefs with other fighters, or you start to, like, you know, play up all this stuff, in my opinion, you're playing a game with your authenticity. You know what I mean? And that's a heavy load to bear. Like, take someone like Chael Sonnen, who, but for, like, I like Chael a lot. I like his shtick. I like him as a person, and I like him as a fighter. But that's a heavy load to bear, to say all this stuff. And he's great at it. I mean, he's a great talker. He's got amazing, all sorts of funny things. I mean, I laugh my ass off listening to him. And he's really good at it. He's the best at it.
He's amazing.
But it's like, you know, do you really want to do that when you have to step in there and be 100% real in that moment, and you have to, like, back up all this stuff that you said? I mean, like, if he can come to terms with it, then he can, and that's up to him. But my whole thing was, I want to be the person that I am inside and outside of the ring. And like, when I was on the show, I was mad. I was angry that there was all these guys who weren't serious. They were screwing around, they were drinking every night, and then there were some guys that were serious, but they were too scared. From the whole situation just scared them, you know, and they were just shutting down. And I watched, like, especially guys on my team, like, I watched their morale break down, especially with the way Matt Hughes was training these guys, and they just, you know, they just broke. And I was like, man, like what's with these guys being nice to my face and then being all silly behind my back? It's like, I would never choose to live with you ever in any other circumstance. And now, not only do I have no contact to or from the outside world, but I'm stuck in a situation where I can't even take a walk in the neighborhood to get away from you guys. So if I saw somebody and they're talking all kinds of shit on me, and they don't like me, and they're drawing little cartoons of me in this, like, juvenile way, I'm trying to, like, win this thing. I see them and I'm like, dude, don't talk to me like I'm your friend. Like, fuck you. You know what I mean? And, like, people are like, oh, man, well, Mac, he's so grumpy and he's mad. Well, it's like, you would be too. I mean, like, this is what I do for a living. This is how I'm going to...
Well,
like,
you had already had a lot of experience before you came on the show. You'd already fought Sakurai in Japan. Right. And, I mean, you were pretty well known. As far as, like, guys getting on the show,
you're
about as well known, an MMA fighter outside of the UFC as you can get.
And so, so what ended up happening was, when I got on there, I took the confidence that I had from all that experience, and I just turned it into... Like I've always been very respectful, but when there are people who disrespect the sport and disrespect this, you know, I mean, I understand it's a show and they pick goofballs like Richie Hightower and stuff like that. But when you take a bunch of guys who are disrespecting this thing that I've dedicated my life to, I'm like, fuck you guys. Like, I'm winning this thing. And I took my experience and I turned that into like alpha male type of, you know, attitude. I was like, fuck this. Like, who's going to beat me? Like, I'm taking out all you guys. And that's the way I operated, and that's what won the show for me, you know?
How much older were you than the average guy on the show?
I think about 4 years older.
And that's that, and big, that's, isn't it? That's
yeah, that
big
is, psychologically. That is pretty big. Yeah, I was like 27, I think, when I was on the show, and most of the guys were in their early 20s.
God, there's such a big difference between me at 21 and me at 27.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Yeah,
me
I was retarded at 21.
Yeah,
it's hard not to be. You know,
how long ago was that? Was that before like you started breaking into acting and everything?
Yeah, I was 21 in 1988.
Okay,
1988. That's when I first started doing comedy.
Right, right, right.
So that was like a big transitionary period for me. No more competition than going into comedy. But I just remember being so stupid. Like,
yeah.
Like in the ways of the world.
Sure,
I was just, I was a fucking dummy. And I think today when I talk to 21-year-olds, I'm so impressed with the how much information kids have today just how the world really works. It's so different than when I was 21. When I was 21, if you had come up to me and asked me a political question, I would have been dumbfounded.
Sure.
I would not have had any answer. I wouldn't. I don't know how the process works. I wouldn't. I would have had no business voting.
Right, right.
but you know, of course I could and did. I think I voted for somebody who lost. I don't even remember who the fuck it was.
Dukakis?
It probably was Dukakis. It probably was. It probably was way back then. Yeah, I was probably, I had a very strong Democratic girlfriend at the time, so I'm sure she probably talked me into voting Democratic.
Babbitt, maybe?
Yeah, no, I don't remember what it was, but I just remember being so dumb at 21, but 21-year-old kids today, they have way more information in their head.
Yeah, yeah, they do, but I still think there's,
it's a maturing process, you just have to go through.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think the information is there, but I feel like, I don't know. I personally look at some of the young people that are like in their early 20s, and I see a lot of the same like passive aggressive ways of handling social situations that were sort of the norm with kids when I was 16 or 17. I don't know. I mean, I guess it goes both ways, but there's definitely a huge access, a much bigger access to information now, especially because of the internet and everything. And I think there's more open-minded people, and I hope that's the way that we're going.
Yeah, the idea that kids are more street smart or more worldly in the days gone past, the reason why that makes sense to me is that you don't just let your kids wander on the street anymore.
Right.
Like, people used to just open the door when they were young, you know, when they had 10-year-olds, and the 10-year-olds just go out in the street. Nobody fucking does that today. Everybody keeps an eye on their kids because, you know,
you can't do that.
Yeah. You can't do that anymore. Yeah. So, guys of a younger generation, just a little while ago, I mean, when I was a kid, that wasn't like a really highly discussed topic of child molesting.
Right.
Because it wasn't like you went out of into the street and you thought there was child molesters everywhere. Nobody even brought it up. Nobody even fucking warned me about it.
My mom did put the fear in me. She was kind of like on the cutting edge of all of that. Looking back at it, like when I was a teenager, I kind of started harboring resentments because I was like, man, like when I was 5 and 6 and 7 years old, I'd have these nightmares about like getting kidnapped and stuff. But man, like all that, like because of just the, like she wouldn't go into detail, but she'd be like, hey, look, you know, if somebody approaches you, you know what I mean? You don't know them. And you know what I mean?
Right,
like you
right,
got to be
right.
careful. And she educated me on all that. It actually saved me one time. There was the man. It was the craziest experience because when I was, I think I was 10, and I lived in this sort of old fashioned suburban neighborhood, which is very near all this stuff that was once rural farmland and had now become industrial parks. And I would cut through these industrial parks to get to my one friend's house. And I went over, you know, like to his house to try to find him, and he wasn't there. And I had a scooter or something like that. And I was like trying to go back, and I had to cut through these woods to get to this Holiday Inn parking lot and then cut through the parking lot to get back over to my neighborhood. And these woods were really, it was just a really small stretch of woods, like very small, just a little wooded area. It's probably like maybe 100 yards or something. And no one's ever there. You know, it's just a little path in between the parking lot and this cul-de-sac. And I get up there and I start walking my scooter because I'm on a dirt path. And all of a sudden there's this guy standing there. And I remember him. He had like a button-up t-shirt but no tie, and he had like reddish hair, like a red little light red beard, and he's like hey how you doing? And I stopped dead in my tracks, and I was just like, oh shit. I was like, this is what she was talking about. I was like hey, and I went to like go past him. He's like, hey, come on up, there's a lot of other kids playing up here, like, go ahead up. And I was like, oh wow, like you're like, and I hurried up and I was just like, I didn't even say anything. I was like, I was just frozen, and I turned around and I took off. And then it was so crazy. It was like there was kids that had been abducted, that this guy was kidnapping kids, and I don't even know what he was doing or whatever, but he was there at that Holiday Inn, and they were following him throughout Western Pennsylvania, and I think they actually found him. But that was the guy, and I was like,
whoa.
I was like, wow, like, what the fuck, you know what I mean? Like, and if it wasn't for my, you know, so it was like all those nightmares and all that shit was probably worth it, because, you know, she, sometimes fear is an important thing to have, just instinctively, you know, like,
yeah.
Somebody can let you know that, hey, it's probably not going to happen. But you got to know the difference, you know. You can't be naive.
Yeah. The moment you realize that you're on your own out there making decisions, and that you can get roped into something like that,
yeah. Fear's not a factor for me, Joe.
It's not at all. No. I was like 6 or 7, I think. I think I was 7, and I was at the library, and some guy came over and showed me these. I was looking in these monster books, like I was into like Frankenstein, the Wolfman,
right.
And the guy goes, I have a lot of monster books in my car. And I go, oh, yeah. Oh, you do? And he goes, yeah. Do you want to come see him? And I go, okay. So I was really young. Right, and I just left with him.
Yeah.
And I'm walking out the door with him. And the librarian sees him.
Wow.
Him, and she yells, she knew my name, she goes, Joseph, you get away from that man, you know. And the guy started running.
Oh, shit.
And then I realized, wow. So I started crying. I was crying like crazy. And then the librarian said that he just got out of jail.
That's a serious close encounter. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's,
if that librarian didn't see what was going on. But isn't that a horrifying job for the librarian, too? I mean, she did it, and thanks to her. I might be dead. I might not have ever survived. I don't know what he went to jail for. I don't know what he's willing to do to not go to jail again. You know, I don't fucking know. But the librarian has to think that, like, while these kids are walking around her library reading books, she has to think that someone can come in and snatch him and fuck him.
Damn, you could have had a big cock there, Joe.
Brian, you need to shut the fuck up today.
Man.
You just got to know when to not say something and when to just stop trying to be silly all the time.
Oh, man.
Well,
the podcast is working, so.
Yeah, this one's live. But see, this is why I tried to avoid it. The kids that get, like, if you let your kid out today, like, that's like a recipe for disaster. Like, nobody wants to just let their kids roam the streets today.
I know, and it's a shame, because it's like, we need to be in touch with the earth. We need to be in touch with you know, all, like, just experiencing society and experiencing other people. And man, it's like, we've got to shelter our kids to a certain extent. You know, my daughter's only, she's going to be 4, but it's like she's the, you know, most important thing in the world to me. And it's like, it was McKenna that said this. It was like he was saying that he struggles with this as a parent. He's like, what'll it be? Like, cynical intellect who's like sheltered, or slack jawed, consumer half-wit of the horse shit handed on from down high, or, you know, like, so in our case, what we're talking about now, it's like even even worse, possibly, you know, like something bad happening because your kid gets in a situation that they shouldn't be in.
But yeah, that's the big worry. And I think that's what we're so aware of today that we weren't aware of as well. But it is a legit concern when people say, oh, we have to live without fear. Yeah, maybe, sort of. But look, there's some horrible shit that's happening out there. For real.
Absolutely.
Like, you can't just deny that. So to roll the dice with your babies, it's not so easy to do when you're aware of what the fuck is going on in the world. We got to figure out how to stop all that and make something an environment where you can let your kids go again. But that's changed radically just in the last, like, 30, 40 years, you know, the way people raise their kids.
I mean, I want to homeschool my kid. I just don't have the resources to do it. And a lot of people, when they hear that, you know, they're stuck in the same modality and the same way of thinking as, like, as everyone else. And they're like, well, what do you mean you're going to homeschool? And how is she going to be adjusted socially? It's like, well, adjusted to what? You know what I mean? There's plenty of other experiences that you can have socially with people and get to know yourself and get to know how to interact with people without going to the institution of public schooling. I mean, public school, like, pretty much, I mean, ruined me. And, like, and when I try to tell people about that, they're like, well, I don't say ruin me, but, like, it definitely sent me off onto a spiraling into a different path. Mm-hmm. And it helped me become the person that I am and everything, my rebellion against that. But it's I didn't have to, you know, I don't want to put my kid through that, you know. And I don't think it was an isolated incident either with the public schools that I had to deal
with. What was wrong with your experience?
Well, I immediately, you know, I was already in public school from, like, first to fourth grade, and it was, like, this strange school where, you know, you had half of the kids or more than half were, like, these rich yuppie kids, and the teachers really, like, favored them. So, like, I guess it was kind of like a social experiment in a way. Like, the teachers were very favorable to these kids, and then there was all the kids from where I was from, which was, like, kind of like the poor area. And a lot of them were, like, misbehaving, white trash type of kids. But they were, you know, they were just kids. And I was sort of stuck in the middle. I was from, like, the poor area. And we just got treated like crap. We got treated like second-class citizens. It was almost like being a minority in this situation. I thought that was really weird. And almost all the teachers there were just hand out worksheets, stay in your desk, that whole thing. You know, I came from Montessori in kindergarten, which is a completely different structure of learning. And we understood mathematical stuff like multiplication just through physical work. Like, they have these beads that you count on almost like an abacus instead of writing things down and doing, like, the worksheet type of work. And so I understood all of that. Like, even going into first grade, I just wasn't able to articulate it in the same way, like this memorization way where it's like 2 + 2 = 4, or, you know what I mean, that type of stuff. It was all just, you know, like hands-on. And so I was just like, what is with you could choose what you wanted to do in Montessori. In public schools, it was just like, you know, they try to keep everybody in line and control, and understand why they have to do that, but the classrooms were big, there was no individualized attention. And then when I was from fifth grade to eighth grade, we had moved to Virginia, and then all of a sudden I became the minority, which is fine, but it was very interesting.
You mean
to
you moved
experience
to a black
that.
Neighborhood?
Yeah, we moved to, like, an all-black neighborhood, and the school, especially the school, like, the neighborhood I lived in was, like, 50-50, but, like, the school that we went to was, like, I think it was, like, 88% black or something like that. And I just watched, like, I mean, nobody cared about the students. There were fights pretty much every day. It was kind of, it reminded me of, like, the footage that I see of prisons, the way fights would just break out, and all of a sudden it was just this crazy thing. And I was always this, like, small little kid, you know what I mean? And I was just, like, you know, I was, like, interested in these fights and everything, and I thought they were pretty cool, but at the same time, I was like, I couldn't get involved with that. I mean, I was, like, 4 foot something, you know what I mean? I was, like, a little kid, and a lot of these guys had already gotten their man size by the time they were in seventh or eighth grade, and I was just like, shit, and I was just watching it happen. So I would resort to, you know, like, my way of getting along in that situation was resorting to, like, class clownism or whatever, because I couldn't, like, beat anybody up at that age, you know what I mean, or, like, stand my ground that way. But I could at least win their favor by, you know, telling the teachers to fuck off or whatever, you know, and they thought that that was really funny, and I was screwing myself up the whole time. And then it was like, okay, well, these people, like, the kids there really didn't like me, you know. They didn't like most of the black kids didn't like the white kids. It was just the way it was. And so at the very best case scenario, you'd be in a situation where you were ignored. In the worst case scenario, you'd be fucked with all the time and picked on. So the best thing to hope for is being ignored. It's like, well, where do you look for your role models at in that situation? And as a kid, people would always tell me, like, well, you need role models and male role models. And I was just like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't need that stuff. And looking back on it now, it's like they were right. You know, you do look for role models and you look for people to set an example of what to do to become a man or to, you know, to just move forward and grow up and become mature. And so I started looking at that. I was like, well, what about these guys? And there was always a little group of heavy metal guys and Metallica shirts and long hair and everything. And they were just smoking cigarettes all day long, skipping school. And I just was like, okay. And I started falling into that. And then it was just like a downward spiral from there. And then once I moved back up to Pennsylvania and there was all these rich white kids who thought they were gangsters, I was like, wow, you guys are really fake. And they hated me because I was skateboarding and stuff. And so I was like, you know what? I was like, I'm done with this. Like, I don't want to be forced into this situation. Like, I want to hang out with the people that I understand. And I hung out with older kids all the time who were already out of high school. And I was done with it. And I was pretty bright, you know. I abandoned, like, the possibilities of moving forward with academics. And I've struggled with that for years and years and thought to myself, well, you know, what if I, you know, I was regretful. I was like, what if I, you know, would have kept going to school and I could have gotten the degree in science that I wanted to, or maybe become a biologist, or, like, you know, done something in one of these fields that I'm really interested in. But looking, as I've gotten older, that regret has started to fade because I'm like, you know what? Like, I think I did pretty damn good for myself. You know, I think I did one of the things that really spoke to me, you know, which is fighting, you know.
You can't have regret for taking a pursuit and enjoying the path. There is no regret
sure.
in that.
There's
there's a choice and, you know, and then there's life. And there's the idea that it would have been better if you went one way or another
way. Yeah,
hypothetical. But the beautiful thing about education is you have access to information that no man before you had ever had in any university.
Absolutely.
Out of your computer.
Yep.
Out of your iPad or your Kindle. You can just fucking read book after book after book after book.
Yeah.
And if you know, you really pay attention to what you're reading, you can get a fucking fantastic education without actually having to go somewhere and have somebody write it on paper.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's just like one of... And I agree with that completely. I was just, for a while, somewhat regretful because of the hypothetical idea of, well, if I did that, that could have been even better. You know, I might have been really enjoying my life because I would like to travel and be one of those people who just lives in the rainforest for weeks on end, gets stung up by mosquitoes, and just, you know, documents insects and knows every single tree frog and finds new species. That is really interesting to me. That's like,
well, that could have been you in another life.
Sure. And so, you know, like, and I would, when things are bad, that's when you always start to look into your regrets. And I had many bad times throughout my entire career. And you know, there was times I was like, man, like, shouldn't have taken this path. You know, it's part of life. You know, you question what you're doing it for and everything. And those were the times when I look back and wish that I would have done those things. But yeah, now, like, as I'm getting older, I hate to, like, put it like a negative spin on it, but, like, I'm seeing how much of a sham the academic institutions are and colleges are. You know, one of my best friends has a master's degree at UCLA and he's going to get his PhD, and it's just, I mean, he's not doing it. He's doing it because he can't do anything else. He can't get the PhD program's paying him, but he can't get a job doing anything else. And he just was watching people just get fed basically lies, even in what's supposedly a prestigious institution like the University of California in Los Angeles. And it's like, man, I'd rather sort through the information and find it on my own, just like you said, rather than, you know, get some kind of a degree and you know, really have nothing to show for it. And I'm not putting down people who get degrees or anything like that. You know what I mean? I think it's...
Yeah, nor am I.
Yeah. But like you said, the information's out there. And if you really just want the knowledge, just to have it, it's there for the taking if you have the time to do it.
Yeah, it's a matter of just immersing yourself in a topic. The information is just readily available.
Yeah.
I think living with regret is a very dangerous thing.
Absolutely.
Put yourself in that mindset. It's a very dangerous thing. I think, you know... You got to just appreciate the now. You know, I always tell people, it sounds completely silly, but it's a great way to think about your life. To live your life as if you were the hero in your own story.
Absolutely.
And the movie starts today. How do you go forth? What do you do? Do what the hero would do.
Yeah.
Do what the person that you would most admire would do. And everyone can do that. We can all be in a movie where the hero wakes up and realizes he's been a fucking dipshit half of his life.
Yeah.
It's time to pull it together.
For sure.
You can do it. Anybody can do that.
And I think for me it was being regretful or feeling regretful was a coping mechanism of just being down and having depression. And it's like, well, you either get through that or you don't.
This is the Vegas Times. We talked about this on the podcast that will never be.
Yeah.
The one that will be whispered throughout the ages.
The lost one. The lost podcast.
It's a conspiracy. They're trying to keep
you moved out to Vegas to try to, you know, to further your MMA career.
Yeah.
But like a lot of people, you found Vegas to be a very scary, hollow, freakish fucking town of depression.
Yeah, it is. I mean...
Not all of it.
Well,
is it happy out there? Like, Penn Jillette's happy out there. I would imagine it. He really is.
Being horrible.
Listen, there's some guys there, like, especially guys that I train with that still live out there. And they seem content and happy. And I don't mean to, like, put these people down. I mean, these people, I respect them and I like them. They're my friends. But in a certain level, they're simple. And I don't mean simple like retarded. I'm talking like they're
simple. Like a Leonard Skinner song.
maybe even not so quite. That's almost like simplicity, like... manifesting like being noble, but I feel like these guys that are able to, I almost envied them at the time. They were able to honestly live their life. Maybe they're suppressing their hate for their life, but it feels like they're content with their life. They come home every evening and they play Xbox or PlayStation, and then they go and they train. They train their ass off, and then they play Xbox or PlayStation. And on the weekends, they either go play paintball or they go to a strip club, and they live their life that way. And it's like, you know what, man? Like that's cool.
That sounds pretty awesome.
If you're into that, but like, I don't know. I mean, So I mean, I had just won the show. I was presented with this contract, knowing like how fickle the sport is and how easily you can get forgotten. And like how easy it is to get dropped from your contract. I was like, well, listen, there's nothing in LA. There's no great MMA teams in LA. There's nothing, no one here to train with. I've got to take this for all it's worth. I'd already been going to Vegas for a while. You know, before every fight, I would always go out and stay with Gray. I'd been doing that since the Zions days, even before Couture ever opened up a gym. And so I knew all those guys, Forrest and Pyle and Jay Haran and Martin Campman and Gray. And so I was like, I'm going to move out there with them and I'm going to train at Couture's. And Tyson Griffin's there now. And like, you know, it's a really good situation. I'm going to have the best training partners and I'm going to work my ass off every day. And I'm going to give this the best shot that I have. And what happened was I went out there and I realized that like, it was just so competitive. There was no nurturing the athlete. There was nobody saying, hey, if you pay me, you know, a percentage of your purse, I will be there for you every day. I will monitor your training. I will help you out. We will study your opponent. It was none of that. It was like you go in, you spar, you're in a war every day, whether it's a grappling day or the stand-up day. It's a physical war. And these guys are very competitive. They've all got the alpha male type of personality. And all the fun got taken out of it. I mean, I would go there, and those guys would go there too. Everyone hated it. I don't care what those guys say. They're my friends. Everyone hated it. Gray was one of the top dogs in the room. Nobody could touch him. Like, you know, once he got to a certain level. For a while, he was just a wrestler, and you could catch him in submissions because he didn't know any better, and his stand-up wasn't that great. And then he turned the corner real quick, and Gray got really good real fast. It was right around the time that he beat Frankie Edgar the first time they fought. And right around that time, he had gotten really good. No one could touch him, and it seemed like he was just on top of the world. And he was hating it the whole time, too. And he was just putting up with it. And all these other guys, I know they feel the same way. And we'd beat the crap out of each other. We'd have so much pressure on us. Everyone has a ton of pressure for every fight. That's just the way the sport is. You go and fight, win or lose. It's time to come back. Do you want to come back to the gym and see the inside of that place again? I know I didn't. And then I would just immerse myself in going to remote places and doing photography and, like, really experiencing nature, which is what I loved, and it spoke to my soul, and so I really liked doing that. And when I would do that, instead of, like I was saying before in the podcast that got lost, instead of feeling refreshed, like, oh, I spent a week and a half, you know, in the desert, and I experienced this timeless beauty and all this stuff, I was like, man, I want to just go back out there again, and I don't want to go back to the gym, and I don't want to study. And it became a job. It no longer became the creative, fun thing that I love doing. It became an absolute 100% job where I was like, okay, time to go to work.
So was it the overly competitive nature? Was it the lack of structure? Was it the fact that it wasn't being done correctly, that everybody was just trying to KO each other all the time?
It was all three of those things, and 115 degree weather, that was another thing, and then just man, I don't know. There was no unity. There was no feeling like, it was like we were all friends and we were all cool with each other, some more than others. But there was always this underlying thing of, especially if you're in the same weight class, well, I might have to fight you one day, so fuck you. You know what I mean? And even though we were cool and we were cordial with each other, you know, and I'd watch other fighters come to the gym, like good fighters would come to that gym all the time because it was a hub, you know. You're in Vegas, maybe cornering another fighter, and so you're going to hop into Extreme Couture because that's where everybody goes, and that's where all the good guys are, and you're going to train, or like guys would come out for a couple weeks, and like Jay Haran and Mike Pyle would just run a fucking clinic on those guys and be mean about it. You know what I mean? And they weren't like, you know, like really, like it wasn't like they were angry, but man, like they would put it on these guys. And it was this real like alpha male competitive thing. And this is competition. And that's one way to look at it. You know, a lot of people might think like, well, that's how you have to be. You have to be like that. But I don't think so. If you look at the way that both Gray and I are training now, and I respect the hell out of Gray because he's been training at a high level since he was 12 with wrestling, you know, and even before that, he's always been wrestling since he was 5 or something, but he's been training at a high level, like hard, high-level workouts, and he knows the difference now. He's training smart, and that's what I'm doing now. I mean, I still spar and stuff, but I'm not in there getting hit, getting the shit beat out of me, beating the shit out of other people, just to try to put myself through the fire to simulate the idea of what a tough fight might be. I've been in plenty of tough fights. I know how to get through them. I know how to deal with my mind. I don't need to prove to anybody that I'm tough. I don't need to prove to myself that I'm tough by getting the crap kicked out of me every day. What I need to do is love the sport again, love the technique, love the art, and man, just go out there and you know, learn again. Learn the techniques again, and then apply them. Apply the techniques that work. That's why with my trainer now, Ciparelli, he's the guy's like a genius, man. And I do not use that word. You know what I mean? With anybody, you know, like the guy's a genius in that respect. And he's like teaching me a whole new language as far as body mechanics and wrestling and grappling and just the fight game in general. He understands it on a whole different level, and he's giving me this whole new language to work with, and there are some words that I'm going to use and put into my vocabulary and some that I'm not, but that's when your personality comes out. I think we were talking about that before. That's why it's so interesting to watch the art of mixed martial arts, because you watch people's personalities manifest in the way they fight.
Yeah, which brings up what you talked about earlier with Chael, how difficult it is to put on a persona and then go into the octagon and compete and have it be real.
Yeah, because you see the stark difference with him. You see his bravado and the shtick that he taps into, and he's amazing at it.
Amazing.
But will you see the contrast in between that and him when he walks into the ring? He is not like looking at the crowd and like you know, doing his little shtick anymore. He is just a man focused, and he has to like focus even more because he's so used to being in that persona. You know what I mean? He has to, and you see such a difference. I mean, look at him after the Anderson Silva fight.
Yeah,
you know the way he was standing. It's like he was like broken for a moment. You know what I mean? He's a tough guy. He's an amazing competitor. He'll get back.
Well, right away he tried to fight John Jones right after that.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's
hilarious.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
He's a bad motherfucker. Dude.
He's really one. He's one of the baddest. Yeah.
The shit talking is unparalleled. Muhammad Ali would have fucking hated it if he had a bout rigged with Chael Sonnen. I mean, look, if it was a boxing match, he would have boxed Chael Sonnen's ears off. But if it was a shit-talking match, I say that I would take Chael Sonnen over Muhammad Ali in a fucking heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know why? Because Chael would sit in front of his computer like a fucking maniac for 10 hours coming up with the right shit to say, whereas Muhammad Ali would try to act on the fly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, you're right. You're right, and I agree with you. However, Ali, his art of trash talking was not none of it was. He didn't have the supply of information that the internet had at the time.
Of course.
So it might have been
much
different.
More poetic with his trash talking,
sure,
too, and original.
No, Chael is great with it, and he's very much so like a Joe Frazier type. If you could like take a boxer and say like what type of fighter would Chael Sonnen be if he was a boxer back in the day, it would be a Joe Frazier for sure.
A grinder.
Yeah, absolutely. Get inside, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting when people, I mean, that to me is one of the best examples of the fact that we're moving forward as a society, as chaotic and crazy as it might be. It's everything of today is better than what it was, you know, in the 1950s. I mean, like, when everybody talks, Marciano was the best, retired, undefeated, Marciano would have done this, Marciano would have broken Ali. Mike Tyson would have ran through Marciano like fire through bushes.
Are boxing historians not the worst? I mean,
they're
love
crazy.
Boxing. I love boxing, and I love the history of it.
Yeah.
But in Sugar Ray, I'm going to use this example. Sugar Ray Robinson was amazing, and he was
ferocious.
Fucking great. But to say that he could have hung in there with like Roy Jones's prime, like boxing people all over the place that are listening to this are saying blasphemy now. All Roy Jones is, it's like they love to discount the new guys, but these guys are amazing in comparison to like just what they're physically capable of than the old
Roy Jones is way too big. That's a weird comparison.
Okay.
Even though,
you're right.
Sugar Ray did go up to fight light heavyweight.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And he collapsed.
But okay, so let's.
He was a tricky one, man. I don't know about that.
If you want a direct example, how about Roberto Duran? I think Roberto Duran would have run through most of the old guys in his weight class. You know what I mean?
Well, he was a real 135er.
Yeah.
You know, Roberto Duran, even when he fought at 147, he was just going up there to fight Sugar Ray Leonard and stayed up there, and then went as high as 60 and 68.
When he fought Iran Barkley.
Yeah.
That was
beautiful. When he knocked down Barkley, I was like, holy shit.
And here's a guy who's got like a serious reach disadvantage, and he's playing the outside, slip on the outside game with a guy who's got a reach. And
a guy who destroyed
punches.
Tommy Hearns, a dangerous striker.
Yep. Yep.
That's when Iran Barkley was a fucking beast.
Yeah,
he was
man.
A strong puncher, man.
He took a lot out of Barkley.
Whoo, fuck yeah. And Davey Moore. Remember when he boxed up Davey Moore? And you're like, God damn.
Yeah.
No one thought, everybody thought Roberto Duran was done.
Yeah.
Roberto Duran had lost to Sugar Ray Leonard in this humbling No Moss fight. And he won in the first fight, and then the rematch, he quit. There's all sorts of speculation as to why he did it.
Yeah.
The range from him being paid to take a dive to him being sick in the ring.
Yeah.
Who the fuck knows what it was, but
something messed with him at that moment.
Something broke, and he was humiliated for years. It took a long time for him to come back to the public's acceptance.
Yeah, man. I admire those people that have come back. Look at Foreman after he lost Ali. He took that hard.
Ten years, man.
He took that hard, but he came back, man. Yeah. You got to give him credit. I mean, regardless of how silly the whole, you know, naming all your kids George and being like a crazy religious person and having a Foreman grill, all that stuff, he's done some amazing things that are truly admirable. And it's like people that can come back from that, that's, you know, those people are my inspiration, you know.
Yeah, George Foreman didn't box from the time he was, I think he was in his 20s till he was in his 30s, and he was like completely fat and out of shape. And I remember he had a comeback fight, and they put it on like the it was like trivia. Like, it was like, what, former heavyweight champion? And then you see him in his comeback fight, and you look at him, you're like, oh my god, this looks so silly. Look at him, like, what, poor George Foreman. And the next thing you know, he's on HBO knocking out Michael Moore to be the oldest heavyweight champion ever.
Michael Moore was my favorite heavyweight at the time, and I remember just being like, I was so distraught when I saw that. I was like, this has got to be fixed. Like, I was a little kid at the time, but I was like, I can't believe that just happened, you know? Because I was hoping that Moore was going to end up eventually fighting Lennox Lewis. Like, they were both really they were undefeated and ranked really highly, and, you know, Holyfield and Bo were still very major players in the heavyweight game at the time. And I was hoping to see that matchup, and that just squashed everything. Moore was never quite the same
again. Michael Moore was a tweener, and really he was like one of the greatest, one of the greatest light heavyweight champions ever. Michael Moore was a destroyer at light heavyweight.
Yeah.
But then he goes up to heavyweight, and those dudes are big, man. Yeah, those dudes are really big.
Yep.
Those Klitschko fellas, like, what the fuck is that? Yeah. That guy was on the plane with us. I forget where we were going. I think it was Montreal, and he was on the plane. The guy stood up. He's a giant. He's this giant, just super athlete.
Those dudes are badasses, and they're very good. And it's Rocky Marciano. It's a shame. I know. It's a shame too, because people have they bring, like, boxing historians and people that fancy themselves as boxing experts that, like, know about the old times. They have some sort of nostalgia or some personal, like, nostalgic connection to these old fighters, and that's great. And these old fighters were great, and they did like acts of human endurance over time span of 20, 30 years sometimes that are amazing, and had so many fights and beat the shit out of themselves just for the, you know, to continue on their career and to make the public happy. And they really destroyed themselves watching what happened to all these guys like Joe Lewis and LaMotta and you know, like Archie Moore and all these great people. But the actual skill, I mean, we're at a higher level right now. And I hate it when people don't want to accept that and they don't want to talk about that. They're just like, oh no, like, you know, you've got to, I give credit where credit's due, but you can't compare the best old fighters to the best fighters nowadays. You know, even with the heavyweight, I mean I hate heavyweight boxing now, I don't really watch it, but even with the heavyweight division being as dismal as it is, it shouldn't take away from how excellent these Klitschko guys are.
Yeah, they are great. Excellent, but I'll be tuning into, like, you know, whatever's playing them, whether it's Showtime or whoever there's, and I'm like, who the fuck is this guy fighting?
Nobody to fight. Heavyweight boxing is just not in a good place right now.
I mean, unless there's like a fight at the press conference, like David Hay and that other dude, what the fuck's that guy's name? I forget his name. They had some crazy brawl at a press conference.
But all that's manufactured. You know what I mean?
I don't think this one was. David Hay punched him in the face with a bottle in his hand.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't manufactured.
Do you remember when Riddick Bowe knocked out Larry Donald or knocked him down on stage? If you ever Google that, Riddick Bowe, Larry Donald.
This was
he hit him with a two punch combination that was like, it was brilliant. Larry Donald had no idea that he was going to do it to him. Larry Donald stood up.
Did he sucker punched him?
I mean, I'm not giving him credit like as if that was awesome that you did that. But the combination was brilliant. They were standing there face to face, and Riddick Bowe just dipped down, I think, through like a left hook and just cracked him right on the chin. And there's, like, if you watch it in slow motion, there's a second where Larry Donald's chin just snaps, and he's still like standing there, like dumbfounded. And then Bo comes down and like dips and hits him with an overhand right.
What were they arguing about?
It was just the same tired boxing thing where two
Brian,
guys
pull that up so we can see it.
Yeah,
it
was, yeah. If you
Riddick,
can find
Riddick, Bo, Larry Donald press conference. Yeah, yeah. I remember that. Did they fight after that?
Yeah, that was the press conference for the actual fight. You know,
well, how many days away from the fight was that?
Man,
I'm
not sure.
Fucked up.
Yeah, yeah, he cracked him. I mean, he got fined and like all this stuff happened. The commission came down on him and everything. But I feel like these guys are always, you know, every single fight that we have now. Like, I love boxing, but boxing is desperately trying to promote itself, and that's why you see like all these little scuffles and all this stuff going on, you know. Yeah, I think this is it.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is it.
Yeah, so...
We're getting excited about the upcoming Riddick Bowe Larry Donald heavyweight fight. This could change your mind.
Oh, my God.
Look how he dips into it.
Oh my God, that's fucked up.
Yeah, you know, it's totally fucked up and it's wrong. And I mean, I'm not condoning it. But
have you seen Riddick Bowe today?
Oh man,
it's terrifying.
Yeah, that's
why
it's scary.
See if you find anything of Riddick Bowe today, Brian. He's you listen to him talk and it's like, oh shit.
Yeah,
and he's only like 40 something.
Yeah,
you know his transformation hasn't even begun.
Yeah, I know. And we were talking about that before last week about how it's scary because there's no science that can really tell you what's going on with your brain.
I had so much on my mind, not to make excuses, but that's just the way it was.
Was it the death of your sister?
That's back then. That's back then.
The death of my
sister. He was fine.
Yeah, this is when he was okay.
Yeah, he was. This is when he was the champ.
So if you can find something of him now, that would be a good contrast.
Yeah, if you look at Riddick Bowe, if you just Google or YouTube Riddick Bowe today talking, the second one down looks like him today, and I'm sure it's horrific.
Yeah.
You know, did you see the fights this past weekend, the boxing matches?
I didn't. I missed them. I missed them.
It was
along with James J. Dillon, the WWE Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's the Canelo Alvarez fight was amazing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They were talking to Paul Williams, the guy who crashed the motorcycle, was paralyzed from the waist down.
Yeah, he was one of my favorites.
Great fighter, but he was struggling to talk. I was listening to him talk. I was like, this guy sounds punch drunk.
I know.
You've seen cage matches. You're going into that 15-foot steel cage.
He's going to do MMA for
you
a while.
Or your opponent
steel
getting
cage.
Really hurt is very great.
Well, it is what it is. You know, the better man to come out.
Now, why do you believe you've been training and all this? It's unfinished business with Andrew Galata. Can you give us any, I don't know, anything, how are you going to beat him in the steel
what
cage?
What a terrible interview with this
I'm
guy.
I'm going to beat him good.
Going to beat him good. Now you've been training.
Yeah, I mean,
again, I
you
know
can't
you're
really
a pro
tell.
Wrestling fan.
Yeah. You know, with this one, but yeah,
He needs.
He's pretty messed
but
up.
If you look at the second one down, it's an actual interview where he's talking.
He gonna know more.
If it says so much to talk about Riddick Bowe, and this is in 2009. The point is. These dudes, they reach this point where it just all falls apart.
And the crazy thing is, it might not even be apparent during their career. Lots of times,
right.
You see it 15 years after they retire. In lots of cases, this is still a new sport.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even boxing.
Yeah.
like combat in the way that it is now is very new.
A hard time.
Well,
like
the thing is, his determination.
Mm-hmm.
I had to outwill him.
Yeah,
and I think that was the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I outwilled him, and so I was able to come up with the decision.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
No doubt that was it. That's the one.
And it's a shame because you know like I mean I struggle with the idea of that possibility myself as well, and I think a lot of the prevention of that can happen in the gym. And I've spent years being the type of fighter that was like, oh. Well, I've got to spar because it's the only thing that would hold my attention because I was so down on myself about the sport. I was like, you know, not interested in drilling or learning technique. I was like, let's just get in and get out as fast as we can and beat the crap out of each other and I'll be able to to get. I'll be able to wake up in the morning knowing that I have to do that, and then I'll go, and my timing will get better and everything. But that is not the way to have longevity. And so now, I'm like loving myself again, loving the sport again, and I'm realizing that, you know, the less shots I take in practice, the less likely my chin is gonna become glass as I get older, and the better I'll be able to have a functioning brain as I get older. You know what I mean? You got to be smart.
Yeah, the thing about taking punishment in the gym is a very real thing, and it's people think that's the only way to do it. I completely agree with your idea that you've had plenty of tough fights, and you know what a tough fight is like, and what you need to do is just work on your skill and work on your conditioning, and then execute come fight day.
Yeah.
You don't the battery that guys take inside the gym is needs to be managed. It really, really needs to be managed, and it's a real problem in this sport that there's so many different ways to do it. Nobody really knows the exact correct way to do it yet.
The sport's still in its infancy.
It really, truly is. As is, by the way, football.
Yeah.
When you talk about head injuries, the newest Sports Illustrated has Jim McMahon on from the Chicago Bears. And I read it, and I started talking to some friends about it, and I started watching some documentaries about it. I've been paying attention to football only for this reason, this head injury thing, really.
Yeah.
It's fucking terrifying. It's only been around 50-plus years, you know? I mean, all these guys are, you know, it takes them 20 years to, you know, end their career and then start having problems, and then they're fucked.
Yeah, and we're slowly watching what's happening, because like I said, like some guys, they don't even show symptoms until way later, way after they retire, you know. Once you get older and other organs stop being as efficient, then all that is brought out. I mean, you're scrambling your brain literally. And the messed up thing about football is like what we were talking about before. They're using their heads. I mean, because the helmet protects your skin, it protects your skull. Your skull won't crack with the helmet. That's what it's designed to do. It, in my opinion, and if you look at it from like a physical standpoint, it centralizes the percussion of the impact. And so, yeah, sure, you can ram your head into a steel post or someone else's helmet or someone's body, and you can rush at them with all the power that you've trained to do and use your head as a weapon. And every time you do that, you're creating a concussion. You're causing your brain to bounce around in the skull, literally. And it's like they don't even feel that lots of times. You know what I mean? Like you can't. Like you get a flash of unconsciousness, or you feel like you get rocked. And they've got these big traps and everything, and they work on their neck strength to help displace the impact for the rest of their body. But it's like, man, you're screwing yourself up every single time, and they don't even think about it. Whereas with fighting, it's like we've got these small gloves, so when you get hit, you know it, and then there's like time when you got to stop and check yourself, like, oh, I got hurt, you know, and you know when you're taking punishment. Whereas with football, it's just you can just go through the whole game, go through a whole career doing that.
Well, and even in MMA, especially if you know you're not being managed by someone or trained by someone who's like really paying attention to you and monitoring you and looking out for you, you know, guys get tagged in the gym and then they have to keep training.
They have a
fight coming up.
Man, I'll tell you what, there if there's great, great trainers out there that understand that and understand all the technical aspects, the mental and emotional aspects, and the health aspects, I don't know of them. And, you know, I'm not...
That's crazy.
You know, like, look, I'm not... Like, people are going to take offense because we've got all these highly publicized trainers, especially in MMA right now. But I've worked with a lot of people, and I know a lot of the fighters that work with a lot of these other guys that I haven't worked directly with. And I don't see anybody really being an amazing trainer as far as monitoring the overall health. I mean, there can be. I don't want to like say that there isn't for sure, but if there is anyone, they're up and coming. I can tell you that much. And we're still the sport's still in its infancy to the point where I think it's going to take my generation of fighters retiring and the few that are able to understand fighting and understand the right
and
smart ways to train. I would love to.
You'd be amazing at that.
I would love to be a trainer. It's just the only thing is I don't really know like how to segue into that, like as far as financially, as far as the financial aspect goes, because I feel like if I just all of a sudden say, hey, I'm training fighters now, hey, you know, I will need at least one or two star people who are making decent money to, you know what I mean, to not only publicize the fact that I'm doing this, but to, you know, to create an amount of revenue to make it worthwhile. Because if I'm training a fighter and they're like at a high level, I want to be there for them all the time. I'm going to have to, you know, monitor every single thing they do throughout their entire training camp and be a monitor of them in the downtime as well, and just, you know, be there for the fighter. And I just it's going to be an interesting thing to see if I can somehow segue into that. I would love to, but I don't know that it's necessarily readily available for me, but time will tell.
Well, it seems like you could probably join up with someone who has good intentions but isn't doing it, you know, what you think would be correctly, or, you know, or doesn't bring to the table what you think you would bring. I mean, you have more than 20 MMA fights. How many MMA fights do you have?
I mean, if you count the fights on the show too, I think I have like 35 or something like that. Or but like I've some of them aren't on SureDog and stuff, but I think I'm like officially like 32, but then something, I don't know, over 30.
That's a wealth of experience, right?
And a lot of, and I've taken, especially in the latter years, taking a lot of break, like long break time in between fights, just due to injuries and just taking time off to reflect and things like that. I was able to work with Gray a lot, and me and Gray have a really good relationship. Gray Maynard, we're actually really good friends. So last fight, when he was getting ready for Clay Guida, I went out of my way, because of the situation that he's in right now, he kind of needs somebody to do that. I went out of my way to try to you know, help him in a trainer type aspect, but the same thing applies. Like, I live in LA, he lives in Santa Cruz, and I just don't have the time or resources to be there with him every day. But I did watch tape of his opponent. I fought his opponent, so I knew his opponent really well. I studied, you know, a lot. We took notes. I helped monitor his training, and I cornered him, and I think that could be something that I want to do in the future. It's just whether or not, you know, I have the facility or the resources to start.
Well, you're an easy
it.
Guy to get along with. I think that would be, you're a rational person, so I think it'd be a good fit for you. And you obviously have a passion for the development of other fighters as well as development of yourself.
Definitely, and I'm an analytical person, so, you know, I know the boundaries of over analysis. So I feel like, you know, I could be a good person for a lot of fighters.
Make an amazing trainer. Yeah, you're an open minded dude too. You're always looking at different aspects. Like, you tell me all the different shit that Rico was doing with you. By the way, I'm also super happy to hear that Rico's working with somebody again. Because Rico is one of those guys that's like the lost talent. Man. You know, Rico's a brilliant guy.
He just, you know, it all comes down. There was a whole lot of things that I didn't understand that were going on at the old Raw gym. You know, I was there.
For the folks who don't know, Rico Ciparelli was one of the original trainers of Raw, which was Real American Wrestling, which was Henderson and Couture, Vladimir Matyushenko, all these like big name guys from back in the day. And Rico Ciparelli was always known as this like really brilliant, super analytical guy who was wicked on the ground.
Yeah. He was one of those people who, he understood body mechanics and combat so well that it was so quick, his transition from being like a high-level freestyle wrestler in college and in on the world stage, and then transitioning to being a Brazilian jiu-jitsu, someone who understood submissions and everything, was just so quick. And he only had to be taught a few things, and like he figured out the rest himself. And I'm saying, like, you know, maybe not in every aspect of life, but in that particular aspect of understanding grappling, wrestling, body mechanics, and combat in general, mentally, emotionally, and physically, he's a genius. And he was working with, I was there with Couture and Henderson and Erickson. Erickson had already left on good terms, and Couture and Henderson, you know, were doing their own thing. And when I got there, it was me and Vladimir Matyushenko and Frank Trigg. And then a few other guys like Fernando Vasconcelos, who I had talked about before, and some other fighters were always coming through. Waleed Ishmael was there.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually was his roommate. Oh, man.
Understand.
That, yeah. Man, you understand.
Let me tell you this guy.
Jiu-Jitsu handshake, man. You ever see that? It's a weird no. three-finger thing. Oh, man. Silly. But
he's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. But Rico, I mean, I just had this quality, and I don't even know. I don't even think he purposely projects it. But people, they want to be around him. They want to hear what he has to say. He's almost like a prophet. He's a brilliant guy. In the social situation of the gym, then it became too dramatic for him. And he really doesn't like drama. He doesn't like being surrounded by the scene of a gym. You know, like all these things, they become scenes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's politics and, you know, people are talking about this and that. And there's all this silly stuff going on. And it's no longer just about learning and training and competing. It becomes this whole other thing, and he got fed up with that. His way of coping with it may have not been the best way, but, like, you know, he had to distance himself from it. And now I couldn't be happier. I'm just honored to be like a part of what he's doing. And that's what he told me. He said, you know, like, I would love to try to make one fighter great instead of just having some big facility where a bunch of, you know, fair weather people come through when they want to and show up. He's like, I want to just focus everything
on. As long as you guys have foil on your t-shirts and like Japanese lettering, as long as you have that,
yeah,
you know, like you need a cool logo.
I know.
Maybe something people can tattoo on their body.
I know. Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, all the affliction stuff is going out of style, so I can't patches across my back and safety pinned onto my other garments.
They fired my man Tom Atencio, so I used to wear affliction stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tom's my friend, and also, Tom, I feel like Affliction MMA, they tried to pay some fighters. They tried to do a good thing. No.
I just think the physical style was ludicrous.
They sponsor a lot of fighters. It's not as bad as Ed Hardy. No. They sponsored a lot of fighters. But I talked shit about them, and I felt bad because I like when guys sponsor fighters, obviously.
No, for sure.
So I bought some of their Dragon jeans.
Yeah.
And I wore them to the weigh-ins. I made, like, a big deal out of it. I still have them, man. My wife tried to throw them away. I'm like, no. You're not throwing out my Dragon jeans. I wore those things only for the weigh-ins. I might have worn them for two weigh-ins. I would announce it on the UG. Yeah, I will be wearing my Dragon jeans because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah, it was so weird. It was like Like, all of a sudden, this subculture has these guys wearing these strange shirts where, like, things are made to look like they're torn with little holes and little worn spots and things stitched all oddly across them.
What's that about?
I don't know. And then these strange, like we're bringing back, like, the heavy metal skull logo stuff. It's like, okay, well, do any of you guys listen to Iron Maiden? You remember, like, Eddie and all that? Do you remember Vic, the Megadeth guy, or anything? And like, they're just, that's not even what it's about. It's just this new retro thing that most of the people don't understand the nostalgia in it, or that it is retro. Like spray tans, faux hawks, and then these like flare boot cut bell bottomish pants that are like have the same distressed look about them, and then those weird square toed shoes that are like patent leather or something like that, that come up really long, and like all these guys are like, it was the most absurd style I'd ever seen, and I'm so glad that that's kind of starting to fade away, but I'm just leery of what is going to replace it.
I'm not sure what's more absurd, the built-in holes or sagging. I don't know which is more ridiculous. I think sagging is more ridiculous than built-in holes.
Well, I think sagging is particularly ridiculous now because especially with the hipster type of culture, and then hipster hip-hop culture now is tight jeans but sag them, and that's the worst style ever, because it's like, if you got some big jeans, you can sag them because they're big jeans, and like, I might not be into that, but it's like, you know, you rock a little bit of a sag because you're wearing 38 size 38 jeans with a 30 waist. I get it. But when you when you have these like these jeans that are made out of denim, but they're made to fit the way that spandex do, and then you pull them down so that you can like see your boxer shorts in the back, it's like really hard to walk around. They're wearing shoes that, like, with no support these days, and just like the, like glasses that aren't prescription, that are just like, you know, it's the oddest thing in the world. And I just, yeah, I don't understand style. I don't understand how these things get popular, why everybody, you know, sheeps together and conforms to these absurd styles. All it takes is one person who is like an icon, or, you know, with the hero worship mentality that we have nowadays, the cult of personality thing. It's like,
is that what it is? Because it doesn't seem to be one person that created that. It seems to have been something that sort of emerged. It doesn't seem, there's not like an example that I can look back and say, well, that guy was the first guy to wear already tattered jeans.
I think it starts to happen and people are pushing for it, and then what validates it is some hero person, and then the other hero person does it. You know, some celebrity. It's a very strange society we live in with just the idea of celebrities and the cult of personality.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. I saw one photograph of this guy who had – oh, that's my fanny pack. There's my dragon jeans. Yeah, that's them. Those are real. Look, they're the dragon jeans with built-in worn-out spots. I told you I wore them shits twice.
Wait, do we have – are we doing this with cars now? Do we have cars that have rust holes and dents in them already?
You can't have that. People want shiny cars. Cars are still shiny. Cars represent your – you know, like you made up going to a nightclub on a red carpet.
Right. Yeah, I was like wondering like when is that going to get popular where people are like kind of taking a hammer and kind of like – banging little holes or cars start being sold with like rust spots already.
Yo,
we have rust.
I just got my shit hail damaged.
Yeah. You're you know, like there's a lot of dudes who are like really into old cars though, and they don't even clean them up. They just drive them around all fucked up. You know, like they don't like take a 65 Mustang and, you know, wax it and make it look nice and take it out for it. No, they like to keep it dirty and fucked up. I don't know. Some people don't feel like they're defined enough by who they are, by their actions, by their work, they don't feel like they're defined enough. So they want to really put out this image and work really hard at it. And they're always gross.
Yeah.
There's just something about people who try like really, really hard. There's something gross about it.
Yeah.
And then there's people that legitimately wear something because that's who they are. And you just, you know, that's what when Joey Diaz wears, like when he was wearing those sweatpants, like he was in The Sopranos all the time. Remember he went through that phase?
Yes.
I don't give a fuck. It's Joey Diaz. I'm happy to see him no matter what he's wearing.
If that's what you feel comfortable with, that's fine. I mean, I've always, at some point, like the slightly baggy jeans, a cargo pants, and a regular t-shirt, just always, like, at some point, I think I was skateboarding when that was kind of in, like, do you know who Mark Gonzalez is, the skateboarder? One of the most amazing people in that subculture that we've ever seen. He's an amazing guy. He's an artist and everything, but he was wearing cargo pants, I remember, in this blind videos, blind skateboards. Anyway, I just took to that, and not because I wanted to be like him, and I was like, that looks cool. It looks comfortable. I tried it. It did. And I've been on that same path for like 17 years now or 18 years. And before that, it was a very similar type of thing. I always thought the faux hawk was ludicrous. I mean, I thought like the faux hawk especially. I was just talking to this girl that I'm friends with the other day. It's like, okay, when you're a little kid, I think I was actually in this situation. You're a little kid, and you're like, I want a mohawk. I want a mohawk like they have like in, you know, like on in the cartoons and stuff, like a punk mohawk, like a tough guy mohawk. No, you're not having that. I'm not going to let you shave the sides of your head and have a mohawk. Well, fine. And then, you know, you take your mom's hairspray, you lock yourself in the bathroom, and you try to smush up like your hair into like a mohawk. It's like, I think I actually did that once, and then I saw what happened. This was like the faux hawk circa 1987 or 86, and I smushed my hair up, and I was like, that's not good enough. That's not going to cut it. And I put it back down, and I gave up on it, and I didn't think about it till years later, and all of a sudden I moved to LA, and there's people like smushing their hair up into this little point.
And it became very different, though. It didn't become like pretending to be a mohawk. It right. Like some...
No, it yeah, it turned into its own thing. But man, what an absurd style that was.
Joey I've Diaz talks about it. He goes, "It's like you're sucking some guy's dick," and he grabs you by the top of the head. He goes, "You're doing it wrong." Smacks you in the face and sends you right back down.
Oh man, that, I mean that's yeah. And I knew a lot of people like friends of mine, like good friends that were like cool people, and I thought were with it. And then one day I'd look and I'd be like, "Dude, you have a faux hawk. Like, what is that?" And they'd be like, "Oh, what? What's the big deal?" And I'm just like, "Well, okay.
There really is no big deal." They are correct. They are correct, Matt. I guess you know they this are. Is wasted. You're worried about I some know. Guy's wonky ass hairstyle.
I know, but it's just so ludicrous. It creates this itch, and the only way to scratch it is by like telling people that it's ridiculous, or by like actually going up to their head.
It is,
like,
but all haircuts are ridiculous. You know, your decision to keep it short, my decision to shave my head, hair's crazy. What to grow it? It's fucking ridiculous. It's a ridiculous body part anyway. Some weird shit that you have to maintain and hack off on kind of.
But what we're doing is a lot. I'd like to think it's a lot less pretentious than the faux hawk. But yes, okay. Yes. I guess I've dumbed down the conversation.
No, it's just it is. No, criticism. You're being. You're just being. What you're doing is you're observing not just this weird phenomenon of people like what you call style, and it's a bunch of lost folks trying to communicate like in really boxy sort of like confined terms who they are.
Yeah.
You know, look, I have skinny jeans on, but I'm sagging. I'm like super cool. I know a lot of black people.
Yeah.
You know,
the
sagging makes me want to take your money, and I'm not even a thief, but it makes me want to pants you and pull your fucking wallet away and run, because it's just, you look like a goddamn victim. I don't get it. It just, Brian, are you faux hawking over there?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, look at you. Wow, faux hawked cool. With just sweat and lack of showering. You faux hawked the shit out of that thing.
It's just pussy juice, Joe.
Whoa, Brian, again. Two hits before a show, never three.
I was watching didn't he do something awkward before the Kat Von D thing?
When did he not do something awkward? Yeah, the Kat Von D thing was one of my favorite ever, because you can see Kat Von D look at him. He told a story about a girl who had a tattoo of her dad as a baby on her arm.
Right.
And he said, "Well, is it weird?" Talking about coming on it. Yeah, guys said, "No, guys, come on it." And Kat Von D was like, "What the fuck?" You could see the look in her face.
It was right in the beginning of the podcast. Yeah. She was probably like, "Oh, no. Am I going to have to put up with 2 hours of this type
yes,
of thing?"
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what I was a little worried about. He went in deep early. And she had never listened to the podcast.
Right,
she had
right.
no idea yeah, what yeah, the fuck yeah. he was going to... You know, people who've listened to the podcast, like yesterday we had on your buddy Rich
yeah,
Roll,
yeah,
great
yeah.
guy,
yeah,
really, yeah. really fascinating guy. Very but cool. he's listened to the podcast. That's why when we were talking and he said, "What do you think of when you think of a vegan?" We were like, "Well, two dudes blowing each other eating a salad." Like,
right, he right, could, right. He didn't get offended.
Of course
yeah,
not.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah.
you know, if you were like some dude who's like really on this podcast right. to express yourself and you didn't right. know that we're retarded.
But you're comedians too. So, yeah. so the punchlines like that just
I would
come
have to
out
say that
you.
About myself. I mean, if that's the joke, look, what is the funny thing about if it's two dudes blowing each other eating a salad. That's what was
right,
funny
right.
in my head.
Right,
I would
right.
have had to say that about myself, about, you know, anything that I enjoy. If that's what's funny, you know, that's why I get crazy when like this Tracy Morgan type shit happens, when Tracy Morgan gets in trouble for saying that if his son was gay, I stabbed that little nigga.
Right,
he's
right,
not
right.
really saying that. Of he's course. Trying to say something totally outrageous.
Of course.
That's just the funniest thing to say
he's,
at that
he's
moment.
He's playing on the in a sarcastic way. He's playing on the idea of the stereotype
yeah.
that most people will think of.
Yeah,
is not even expressing your opinion. So. In order to get offended by that, you know, like it would have to be presented in a much different way.
Yeah, that's really driving me nuts about this literal aspect of our culture
yeah.
lately. When it comes to stand-up comedy, it's because you're playing dumb. You're playing dumb in order to call gotcha on somebody. You're pretending that that comedy is in a really subtle and weird, nuanced part of human expression, and you're just taking it literally. You're choosing to listen to what he says and look what I have written down.
Right,
these are
right.
the words that came out of his mouth. Like, that's ridiculous. Yeah. To take that out of context like yeah. that is, it's a moron's game. And when you're totally. Locked arguing with a moron about whether or not that should or shouldn't have happened,
that's
you're
the
trapped.
Worst thing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this, you can't do
this
it.
There's a guy
yeah.
named Brian Holtzman. He's one of my favorite comics in LA that nobody knows about. Some people are starting to know about him. We got to get Brian Holtzman on the show.
That'd be awesome.
I love the guy. He's a great guy. But his whole act was just saying the most preposterous, mean shit. He came on stage at the Comedy Store maybe a week after Susan Smith had drowned her kids. And it was like this crazy thing with his mother had drowned her children. And he goes, I heard those were bad kids. He goes, ladies and gentlemen, I heard they never put their blocks away. They sat that close to the fucking TV. He goes, those kids would not be missed. And it was just... It was just ridiculous. It was so ridiculous that was just this uncomfortable, sustained laughter through the Comedy Store. Like, oh, no. But we were all scumbags. I mean, he was telling this to a bunch of dirtbags in the darkest, most demonic club in Hollywood. And he always went on late. They always put Holtzman on late. So it was like, you know, probably like midnight or something on a Tuesday.
Everybody had a lot of drinks in them, yeah.
On midnight on a Tuesday when you're watching Brian Holtzman on stage at the Comedy Store, anything can happen.
Yeah.
But that to me.
But you're in a comedy club.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the art. It's like, how do you push the boundaries of the art that you're doing? It's like, well, my art is making your art is making people laugh. And there's all sorts of ways to go about doing that, and we have a framework to work with. You know, we're standing up, we're doing a routine, we're talking about things. Why not go there? You know, like, why not do that? Why does everything have to be so literal?
You know, you don't have to like it.
Right, and if you don't like it, then that's fine. But what'd you come to, a comedy place for? You know,
I mean?
Like,
some people are going to like some styles of comedy, and some people aren't, you know. But to pretend that it's literal is like pretending the X-Men are really fighting aliens. It really is. It's like pretending that that vampires can go outside and be sparkly. You know, they sparkle in the sun and they just want to romance you. Get the fuck out of here. It's fiction.
Yeah.
Stand-up comedy is just a form of expression. And Brian's form of expression is derailing conversations or really uncomfortable moments about coming on tattoos of babies. Mm. That was his move, you know. You got to understand. That's not what he really would talk to you about on a regular basis.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. I know the guy.
That's cool, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what's funny and what's not funny? It's like, who knows until you try. That's the other problem. Sometimes the trigger between thinking something might be funny and pulling it, you have a very short window where it's really going to work.
Yeah.
And sometimes a bullet comes towards you and you're like, do I let this go? Am I letting this one go? What are we letting this one go? Let it go! Let it go! And as you're letting it go, you go, oh no, this poorly oh, do you know you're drunk and you're letting that one go? And like, you don't know how to articulate it correctly.
Yeah, there's the attention span of the audience to deal with, you know, like when to pull the trigger and when not. And then there's the difference in the demographic of the audience, you know.
Sure.
I don't know if you're going to do the same routine, you know, in North Carolina that you do in LA or whatever, you know, like how you're going to change that, if you're even going to bother changing. But I'm sure you'll notice a difference in the authenticity of their reaction and, you know, a lot of other different things.
I believe the word is authenticity.
Authenticity. I do get punched in the head for a living. That's see, every time I pull out, like I expose myself for being stupid, especially with vocabulary or speech, I can just always fall back on that. I get hit in the head for a little.
Do you seriously monitor that? Do you say, like, okay, the moment I feel like a little weird, I'm done?
Yeah, yeah, I do.
Because you seem totally lucid. I've known you for at least 7 years now.
Yeah.
You haven't changed at all. I knew you before you ever got on The Ultimate Fighter.
Right,
training at Legends.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the same guy.
Yeah, we were training at the Bomb Squad.
So. Yeah, old Legends.
Yep.
But you know, we both know guys from that era and before who are not the same guy now.
I know. Yeah. My only fear is that, even though I'm monitoring it, that it might come out long after I retire, which is what happens to some people. And if that happens, I sincerely hope that doesn't happen, but if it does, it's because the damage has already been done and there's nothing that I can do about it from this point forward. All I can do is train smart, you know, like if you look at the way that I'm training now, if you look at the way that, like, Gray Maynard is training now, like, we are no longer, like, killing ourselves for this sport and hating every moment of it just so that we can try to win and bask in, like, the wonderful glory of winning on that one night. It's like, you should enjoy every day. And yeah, it's like, you know, bad days are going to happen, but you should enjoy every moment of it, and you shouldn't be physically hurting yourself. Obviously, you don't want to blow out your knee. You don't want to hurt your back when you're training. Why would you want to hurt your brain? You know what I mean? Like this is something that we have to think about. You have to train smart, and you have to figure out ways to keep your speed and your timing and your reactions on point, and at the same time not go in there and hurt each other. And you can't be hurting your partners either. I used to beat the crap out of my training partners to the point where I had like taken their morale down to a peg, to the point where they would never give me a good spar because they were just worried about me beating the shit out of them all the time. And that's no way to train. It didn't better me. It was just me being like being so fed up with my spot in the sport that sparring was the only thing that would hold my attention. And then I just became a bully. Even these people were my friends, and I don't have a bully personality, but it would just be like, okay, well, we're sparring today, and I'm going to win the sparring session, and then like that's what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to beat you up, and like I would do it, and these guys, you know, like they were afraid, and like I would watch the anxiety just like billow off of them like smoke before every fucking training session. They'd be like, oh man, like I got to go in there and spar with him now.
Did you experience that sparring with any people, that same sort of anxiety, so you could see it in yourself?
For sure. Yeah. Like I experienced that while I was at Couture's, even with the guys who I didn't feel were at a higher level, but like it was just every day
was war.
Every day was war. You know what I mean? And like I would go in there and it would be it would be daunting. It would be like, okay, I'm exhausted. I just did a ridiculous amount of cardio and weight training this morning. Oh. And it's 116, 17 degrees outside, and I've got to go back in. And once I go in, I'm going to warm up, and nobody's really going to talk to each other. Nobody's going to discuss anything. And we're all going to try to like hit each other while not getting hit. And like day in and day out, then I started to loathe competition. Just the idea of competition bothered me. When I'd come home, I would not want to play chess with somebody. You know what I mean? Right, like the idea of trying to beat somebody or best someone in a contest was just
overdone.
It made me feel sick, and I was like, I don't want to have any. And that's why it sucked so bad, because then I would fight, and win or lose, after the fight I'd be like, I don't want to have anything to do with fighting. And then people would be like, hey, did you see the fights? I don't want to think about fighting. And then I became like all disgruntled and negative about it, like I don't watch that shit. I don't watch it. You know what I mean? Like that's who I was. And it was like, well, there's this ironic thing. You've got this professional fighter, and he doesn't even watch it, and he doesn't like it, and everything. And it was just me trying to deal with my personal life and like my career at the same time. And just it's like, and it was. I'm glad I had the experience.
What do you think of when you see a guy like Brock Lesnar jump in? A guy who. Clearly, he's a freak athlete,
right?
But clearly, also has had a very limited amount of striking.
Yeah,
and doesn't feel comfortable on his feet. And then all of a sudden, he's fighting fucking Cain Velasquez and Shane Carwin. He's in the big leagues right away. Yeah. Randy Couture, and like what was that? His third professional fight.
I try to look at things really objectively. There's one way to look at that, which is, what the fuck? This guy doesn't belong here. He didn't pay his dues.
He's got mad balls, though.
That guy
has mad balls.
Right. And that's one way to look at it. But I really don't look at it that way. Even the fighters that I don't like personally, that are marquee fighters that do make a lot of money in the sport, I'm always happy to see anyone making money in the sport. And it's like, well, this guy came from pro wrestling. He was already making millions of dollars. But you got to expect that, especially with the heavyweights. You got to expect guys like that to just come in every now and then. And I think that we're going to see a lot less of it as the sport progresses and as it becomes this deal where new guys are coming up. People are becoming amazing fighters at the age of 16, 17 now. And by the time they're in their 20s, they're ready to go. We're seeing less and less of that sort of thing. So it was like, you know what? Let him eat his cake, and if it makes him sick, then so be it. And that's what happened.
And eat it too metaphor there. Let him eat his cake, and if it makes him sick, then so be it. And then it's seeing how you're so careful about your diet. It's very funny.
Man.
I feel like he's one of those guys that epitomizes that old joke about the young bull seeing the cows, saying, "Hey, let's run down there." there and fuck a cow. And the bull says, let's just walk down there and fuck them all.
That's right. That's right. What movie is that from?
I don't think it's a movie. I think it's an old joke.
It is an old joke. But
is it from a movie?
There was a movie. Yeah. Man, I'm losing it.
I don't remember it. But it's a super old joke. But the idea that they would take him and throw him in there in the second pro fight against a guy like Mir. You're crazy. Like, I mean, he might have won if Mazzagatti didn't stop because he was punching him in the back of the head. He might have won that fight on a TKO right there. But it's still not worth it. He doesn't understand the submissions enough. Why do that when you got a freak?
Right.
When you got a guy, you know, he needed someone who would listen to him, said, listen, man, we do this right, and you're the greatest of all time. You know, if you really want to do this, you really want to do this. Because if you don't really want to do this, you just want to get paid, you can just jump in there and see what you can do right now. But you look at a guy like that, you're like, obviously, that guy has some freak physical abilities. Ever see a video of him walking around on his hands?
No.
Hands, you know, can run a ridiculous fucking 40-yard sprint. He can leap through the fucking air. He's a freak.
Yeah. No, I think, like, he was one of the few people who has the power to pull that card of the fast track, and he did.
Yeah.
And with a little bit of luck and a lot of ability, he was actually able to win fights. And like, as soon as you win a couple fights in a row, especially against guys like Carwin and Mir and Couture, it's like, oh wow, well, you know, I see holes in his game, but holy shit, he's winning and he's beating great fighters. He's the man, you know, and that's all it takes in this sport.
Yeah, but when he fought Alistair, and he fought Alistair Overeem after having stomach surgery, he had 12 inches removed from his colon, and then he fought one of the scariest fucking strikers to ever compete in MMA, and got kicked repeatedly in the body.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to go, who is talking? Someone talking to you? Is someone managing you? Because you what you guys got here is the
money
craziest
is managing
goose.
Him.
Yeah, but that's the wrong way to look at it. You got the craziest goose that laid the golden egg ever. You know, a Brock Lesnar career could be an enormous, enormous career. The build-up to him actually challenging for the heavyweight title could be him fighting competitor after competitor over and over and over again.
I don't know that he would have wanted to do it that way, though.
Yeah, I bet he wouldn't
I think he just wanted a fast track to it, and he's one of the few guys who had the power to pull that
card. And he probably thought he could beat all those guys.
Yeah.
He needed someone to look at him and say, just listen, man, you just need to watch some Alistair Overeem kickboxing bouts and understand what the fuck is going on here.
Because
this isn't as simple as you throw a punch and then he throws a punch. Every time you're punching, he's stepping, he's measuring you, he's going to step twice and then kick your fucking legs out.
Yep.
And by the way, if he hits you once, your leg's not the same ever again. That leg's done.
That guy.
You ever see the Brett Rogers fight?
Yes.
Jesus.
Yes.
He hit Brett Rogers with this fucking thigh kick. He slams that shin into Brett Rogers' thigh, and you see a look on Brett Rogers' face like, holy shit, what have I gotten myself into?
Yeah.
Because it was just step, wham! And it was like, oh no, more of these are coming? Like, that was too quick. That was too confident.
Overeem is like an experiment, you know. He's turned himself into quite a dangerous man.
Yeah, he's a weird guy, right? What a trippy career. The guy goes from being a skinny 205er who keeps gassing out. What do you think? Do you think it's all horse meat?
I don't know. Hey, listen, man. I know when I take my Advil, you know, like lots of times there's just testosterone pills mixed in with it, and I'm just like, oops, and all of a sudden my testosterone levels are really high. Just lucky for me, they just haven't tested me yet. But
is it Tylenol they inject into you? Because that was what this doctor did. Apparently this doctor is fairly sketchy, so you know,
look
in that
situation, I don't care how dumb you are as a fighter. I'm tired of this bullshit naive act that these fighters pull. Well, I was taking the supplement, and this doctor told me to tell the supplement, or it was an over-the-counter supplement. It's like, no, shut up. Just fucking admit that you're doing steroids. But the track record is that a lot of these guys have learned to just deny mm-hmm. it, and then if they deny it, I mean, I've watched guys. I'm not going to name any names, but there are guys that I train with that would be like, I've never done steroids before, ever. I don't know what they're talking about. Like, there was one guy in particular, and everyone knows that he's on steroids. He's a great guy, but everyone knows he's on steroids. And the mother of my child, who I was with at the time, is a massage therapist for athletes. And she went over to his house, and she came back, and she's like, how come he has in his house, in the fridge, all these vials and syringes and these bottles that have like pictures of horses on it and stuff. And I'm like, why do you think? And he's like, yeah, but he said that he never did that before. It's like these guys would lie to their own mother about it. They would like lie on their deathbed about it. I don't know. It's just like this shutting off the brain thing. It's like, just admit that you did it. You know what I mean? Like that goes back to what I was talking about before, about this being an honest, authentic event. Like, this is why I do it. Like, you can't make anything up. Like, this is not a movie where you had 50 takes to get the scene right. This is a one-time thing. You're being honest with yourself. All the training, everything you do culminates into this. Why do you want to, like, be a fake and a liar outside in other ways? And if you do, then that's your prerogative. But it's like, man, like, I could never live with myself, like, going around telling people, like, that I didn't do something like that. It's like, you guys know what doctors are giving you.
What percentage of guys do you think are using performance-enhancing stuff that's illegal? Because for sure there have been a bunch. I mean, one thing to clarify, there have been a bunch of companies who've been busted for putting stuff into their supplements, just regular shit that you buy at GNC that contains illegal compounds and stuff that will test you positive for steroids. And that's how they get results. What they're doing, they're getting results by essentially selling you steroids, just not telling you in the list of ingredients that it's a steroid. People take it, it works. I mean, there's been a series of different things that have been pulled from the shelves and have proved that. Victor Conte guy has talked pretty extensively about that. And he's about as big of an expert on the subject as you can get. He's a former head of Balco, which was a company that created a designer steroid to mask from the test. So in his opinion, there's a lot of those false positives. But outside of that, what percentage of guys are using?
Okay, this may be a shot in the dark, but I have, you know, a lot of access. I mean, I know all these people, and I know of them, and I train with them, and I deal with them. I would say at least 60% are on them all the time, and I'd say up to 85 or 90% total have at least done them at some point or tried them.
Now, how are they on them all the time and then they pass tests?
Well, these guys cycle the stuff. You know, they take it and then they know how long it's going to take for it to get out of their body. And like, when I said that 60 and 90% thing that I just thought of in my head, that was my estimation, I'm also talking about HGH, human growth hormone, which isn't something that is tested for right now, just because it's hard to test for it and it's very expensive to test for it, and the commission is not going to pay that kind of money. And it's still very random. You know what I mean? Like, I wish they would just test everybody. Why, like, instead of doing this random thing where, hey, you might get picked and you may have to do the piss test, it's like, make it a requirement for, we have to all have to submit physicals and blood work before every fight. We have to do that, and once a year we have to do ophthalmological exams, the eye exams, the dilated eye exams. So why don't we have, instead of just HIV and hepatitis, why don't we have anabolic steroids? Why don't we do tests for the levels and all that stuff every time? Why? Is because it's too expensive and people are pinching pennies, and that's what the commission's doing. That's the way I look at it. And it's like, test everybody, and then we will have. You can either sink or swim. You can keep taking the stuff, and it can be a mental crutch for you, and you can feel like, oh, I can't perform anymore because I don't have my steroids. It's what's been helping me win forever. Or, you know, you can learn to live without it, like I do and like a few people do, and it's just like, train without it. You don't need it. I don't want to look back on my career and be like, well, I did some great stuff, but I did that great stuff when I was taking all these steroids. And, you know, while I was taking the steroids, then that's what helped me, and it wasn't really all me. I don't want anyone's help. This is about the individual, the martial artist. This is about their journey, trying to better themselves in the art with their technique and with their training. And it's just it's a journey. It's like, why do you want to you know, screw that up?
You have a very noble point of view on this, but how many people share it? How many guys, you know, I know there's guys like John Fitch I've had this conversation with John. He shares that exact same point of view. And he very specifically said to me that he would never want to think that he couldn't have made it without, you know, taking something.
Sure.
And even though he knows that it would make him a faster athlete, it would make him better, it would make him stronger, he doesn't ever want to think that there's no way he could have made it without this stuff.
How many other guys feel that way? I don't know that very many of them do at all.
That's an astounding number that you gave me.
That's my honest estimation.
No one's more no one is more qualified to give that estimation than you.
Yeah.
Or a guy like you.
And the thing is, like, years and years of training with different people and everything, and then, like, you know, whispers start to come out. Oh yeah, he's on this. You know, you hear things. I never go public with it. I usually don't talk to other people about it. I certainly don't name names. It's their, you know, prerogative. They can play with it if they want. But, like, the more and more I stayed in the sport, the more and more I see, oh, wow, I thought that guy was clean. I thought he wouldn't do that. The thing with me was I had a certain amount of principles that I had when I came into this. And I was just like, I don't want to do that. You know, I just don't want that to be a part of my personal legacy, even if no one ever knew about it.
I believe you. I know you. I believe you. What you're saying is absolutely true. But do you know how few people are so, especially few people who aren't wealthy, they're not, you know, they can't retire and live the rest of their life. You're so dedicated to those principles. It's such a rigid and a foundation of your character. How did that set in with your life? When did that become you?
I don't know.
Because this martial arts attitude that you have, it's not bravado. Right. I know you. It's not like, I'm not, you know, I don't need no bullshit. I'm going to kick everybody's ass anyway.
Yeah.
It is more of a, you know, you are doing it all the correct way in your eyes.
That's why I chose this. That's why I'm not working for a corporation in a cubicle or something like that. That's why I'm not like, you know, when I had those types of jobs, I felt horrible about myself and about my life. And when I finally decided to try to take MMA for what it was and dive myself into it 100% and dedicate myself to it, I was like, I had nothing to lose. And I'm like, this is a perfect path because I'm either going to make it or I'm going to break myself doing it. And I don't know what goes through these guys' minds. The idea of winning is too enticing, the idea of having an edge. And I watch guys and I know people who became so addicted to that stuff that when they don't have it, then they have this insecurity in the back of their mind, in their subconscious, and they don't think that they can actually pull off what they did when they were on the juice.
What did you think of when you saw, like, the Pride era? Where it was just super clear that no one was tested for nothing. And in fact, I have friends who fought in Japan who were told to take steroids.
Sure. All those, almost all those guys were, and it's just, while it was happening, I was just in limbo because I was trying to work my way up in the lightweight division and small shows where there's all these scumbag promoters that are just trying to screw you over, and I was like, you know, seeing the lightweight division be completely dissolved for a few years, and I was just like wow, like the closest guy to my weight that's fighting in any kind of show that's getting paid more than $10,000 ever is like, you know, it was like High and Gracie versus that Ichigawa or whatever. You remember, like, I'm like looking at guys that walk around at like 190 pounds, and like that's, you know, so it just, it's, I guess what I'm saying is it seemed so otherworldly to me that, I mean, it was MMA and I was interested in it, but it was just like, it didn't apply to me. I was just like, well, that will never be me. Now, even if I did like throw my principles out the window and just decide to take a bunch of steroids, it'd still be lightweight in frame. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and I just, like, that would be silly. Like, I would look like that. Was that, remember that guy Jimmy Ambrose? You ever heard of him? Yeah.
Yes.
It looked like that. You know what I mean? Like, that's the only way I could get up to heavyweight.
That guy was 300 pounds and like 5'6".
I remember
he's
all
powerful
these,
dude.
Yeah. He
wasn't 5'6". He's taller than me, I'm sure. I'm only 5'8". How tall is he?
I think he was like 5'8". Yeah.
And he's like 300 pounds of solid muscle.
And huge lats, and it's just, he could never put his elbows in.
Yeah.
I'm learning a lot about technique, and it's funny. Like, a lot of people scoff at this because they're like, "Oh, well, you've been doing this for 10 years and you're learning now, haha." Like, good for you. It's kind of weird that you're learning again. It's like you can never master all of this. But I'm really understanding that elbows in and bringing everything into the core, and almost like 99% of all the techniques you do is very important. And that guy literally could not do it because he's in constant bench press mode. Yeah. He's ready to bench at any time. Like, you know what I mean? Just the way he walks.
But if that guy got on top of you, oh, what a nightmare.
Yeah.
Big strong guy like that gets on top of you.
That's sure.
I think he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's a black belt under Carlson Gracie, isn't he?
Oh, wow. I don't know.
Not to talk bad about the guy, but
that's not what his frame is designed for. Yeah, I guess
what you're saying.
Yeah, and I've gone off on a long tangent, but what I want to say is that watching that stuff with Pride, like, my feelings were just like, hopefully the sport will change, and the UFC did change it. They brought in the lightweights, and you know, I was able to compete with guys, you know, my size.
Yeah,
and
for folks who don't know, Mac fought at 170 on The Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah.
And the dude that you fought in the finals, Tommy, was a big fucking 170.
Tommy Spear. Yeah.
Tommy Spear's a big fella.
Yeah. He was big, yeah. But I knew, like, just from training with him, he was very green. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't mean that in, like, the eco green sense. In fact, he's the antithesis of that. And
Is he?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, he's a dairy farmer. You know what I mean? That's like what he did. The guy had never ever eaten a pineapple in his life.
Whoa.
He had never eaten a mushroom in his life.
What?
He didn't know what a mango was. And he didn't know what an avocado was.
Holy shit.
And this guy was eating bacon out of the package the way you'd eat lunch meat. And he was just, and we were like, yo, Tommy, like,
you could die from that,
yeah,
dude.
You could die from that. Yeah. And he's just like, oh, this is, what, it isn't. I'm like, no, it's not pre-cooked. This isn't pre-cooked. And he's like, oh. I'm like, dude,
it's raw fat.
That's just the way he. Who knows? I mean, this is a guy whose only vegetable experience is like corn on a plate, or maybe like peas or something like that once a year.
Frozen
or something.
Peas. We found some peas, Tommy. What's that?
Yeah, he was a big dude, and I mean, I just knew though that he was very young in his experience and his understanding.
Did they hook your diet? You're a vegan. Did they hook your diet up while you're in the house?
The one good thing, even though with all the negatives about being there and the no contact to or from the outside world and no freedom, the one good thing that they have is you can, food-wise, you can order pretty much whatever you want. You can tell them whatever you want. As long as it's, you know, at Whole Foods or at the regular grocery store, they'll go and get it for you as long as it's within reason. So guys were even like ordering like the most expensive stuff they could get. Like, they want like flounder from the deli and like filet mignon and all this shit. And I was able to keep my diet like on point. And that was one of the things I established from the beginning. Like, I was worried about that kind of like the idea of guys being, you know, being jokesters and messing with somebody's food. And like from the very beginning, I just gave these guys that look. Like, when I look at them, like, you're not going to fuck around with me. I'm not going to be like the butt of your jokes. You aren't going to, like, you know what I mean, pee in my bed. Like,
don't come in my lettuce.
Yeah. Exactly. That's not happening. You know what I mean?
Did someone do something like that?
No,
someone's food, something like that.
I don't watch that show.
Sushi?
Yeah. He's like, I don't watch that show. I got better stuff to do. No, but one of those seasons. The season that Ryan Bader and what's that kid, Felipe Nover, the season that they were on, we had two different weight classes, and someone peed in Ryan Bader and Felipe Nover's like fruit or something like that. They peed all in it, and those guys just ate it, and they were cool with it, and they didn't even think anything of it. And then, like, when they heard that it had been peed all over it, then they started feeling sick and were like trying to force themselves to throw up and stuff. But yeah, nobody messed with my stuff. The only thing that happened was guys on my team, like guys that I was supposed to be friends with, were like eating my food. And it was like, look, you guys can eat whatever you want. You can order the same stuff that I order, or you can eat your own food. But my diet is very specialized, so don't take my stuff, like, right. It's public domain. So I started like writing my name all over. They didn't show it on the show, but me and this other guy named Billy that was on my team grabbed this this like small refrigerator that was in the back, near the grill outside on an outlet, and like brought it into the room, and it was like my personal like dorm refrigerator, and like I kept all my food in there. And so yeah, nobody messed with it or did anything with it. It was just there
it's
was
a
an
shitty
issue
thing to have to think about, though.
I know. Yeah, it was hard, man. It was hard. I don't know how I got through it, but I did. I just kept my eyes on the prize, and I was like,
When did you switch your diet over to vegan?
2004. Yeah.
What was it like before that? What was your diet
up until that point? Okay, let's see. When I was like 16 or 17, I was kind of like, I'm done with red meat and pork. I just like for health reasons and just I don't know, like my own half-assed moral ethical reasons. I was like, I just don't want to mess with red meat and pork. It's bad for you. It's just I don't agree with it right now. So I stopped that. And then when I was about 19 or so, I realized that all these ear infections and sinus infections that I'd been having for years and years, like seriously bad ear infections, like I would get them at least twice a year to the point where there would be so much pressure that my eardrum would inevitably puncture. And it was the worst pain that you could think of. I mean, I've broken my femur before. I've had all kinds of like bad physical pain. Nothing is as bad as a few of those ear infections. And those ear infections, the pressure on the brain too, you can almost feel it too. It's incredible. And it's very sensitive in there. And then I would get vertigo for like months afterwards. And I don't know if you know what vertigo is like, but it's absolutely miserable. Everything is spinning all the time, and you try to focus on different spots in the room, like the corner of a door or anything, just to force your brain to remind your body that you're not actually spinning, but you can't stop your eyes from doing that. Like if I were to spin around and around in a circle, you know how your eyes go like this and dart back and forth to try to catch up? It's just like an involuntary reaction. Well, your eyes are doing that. I would even close my eyes and try to like put my fingers on my eyes and they just be darting back and forth because your equilibrium's so messed up. And when it is okay, you try to go walking around, you still feel like you're in an episode of Cops. Like everything's sort of bouncing around. It's you completely feel detached. It feels awful. And so I dealt with all that, and what I'm getting to with that is that and this is a personal thing. This is a personal allergy. Not everybody has this. Not everybody has to quit dairy because of this. But dairy directly affects a lot of people within the sinuses, the ear, nose, and throat. That's why, like, if you drink like a glass of milk, you feel like, you know, there's like phlegmy. A lot of phlegm. Yeah. Well, I developed like a severe allergy to it. And it was probably due to the fact that I was drinking milk constantly growing up. Like my mom thought that you know, she believed the bullshit like you know, grow big with milk. You know, like osteoporosis, strong bones, and all this crap. And I was drinking a ton of milk growing up. And I think that contributed to my allergy possibly. But anyway, I tried all sorts of stuff, and I finally came to the realization after reading some stuff from Andrew Weil, who's the dude with the beard, the not homeopathic necessarily, but like holistic medicine guy. And he was like, if you have problems with your sinuses or ear infections, eliminate milk and all dairy products. I did, and I haven't had a single problem with ear infections since then. So that was when I was about 19. So I spent 10 minutes off on a tangent. You asked me what my diet was like before 2004 when I went vegan. The only thing that separated me from having a vegan diet was chicken and fish. And the reason why I was eating, and maybe turkey, you know, like poultry and fish. And the reason why I was eating that stuff is because I believed what everybody had said beforehand, that you need some type of animal protein in your diet. And also, like, I like chicken. You know what I mean? I like the salty, greasy stuff. I like the flavor. You know what I mean? It was cool. Even like regular grilled chicken breast or whatever, you put seasoning on it. I was like, well, this is what I'm supposed to eat. And so I would eat that stuff. And I was, you know, thought to myself, okay, one day when I'm done trying to be an athlete and when I don't need this animal protein that everybody says I need, I will stop eating that and I will have a vegan diet. And what I told myself was, I will not call it vegan. I will just live like that. I will not wear it on my sleeve. I won't become part of some cult. I will just do it because I feel that it's the right thing to do as a consumer in this day and age. And I want to address that too. I think we're omnivores. We're made to be able to either eat meat or vegetables, and plants, nuts and everything, or a combination of both. And, depending on where people lived and like what part of the world they lived and what they had access to and what they could hunt or not be able to hunt for, they would eat a combination of both or just one or the other. And this is and we have the ability to do either. We live in a day and age now, though, where we're not the hunter-gatherer anymore. If I live back in the day, or whatever, some hypothetical situation hundreds and hundreds or thousands of years ago, I would, if that's what I had to eat, that's what I would eat. I have compassion for animals and all living things, so I would feel bad about it, but I would respect what I killed, much like I feel my soul tells me that, much like the way that a lot of Native American tribes did, they like revered the animal, they killed it, they ate it, they used everything, they didn't waste it, and they respected what they did. And it wasn't like, yes, like I want to hurt this thing. It was like, this is our food, we have to kill it for food. That's different than this day and age where you have mass amounts of suffering. Even in like lots of people that are vegetarians that eat milk and eggs and things like that, it's like the if you care about the animals at all, the moral issue is still the same. These animals are living in horrible situations and they're suffering. Like, whether or not you like animals or think that they have like the same, abilities to reason or, have any emotions or anything like that, the one thing is true. They feel pain. And they can feel pain and they live in the worst, most fucked up situation. So I was just like, look, I'm a consumer. I don't want to be. If I could live exactly how I would be, I'd be like living off the land somewhere. But that's just like a pipe dream. I'm a consumer. I buy stuff. If I'm gonna buy stuff and I'm gonna like contribute directly to things that I buy, I don't want to contribute to this industry. It's just wrong for me. And I don't want to tell other people what to do or force it down their throats. And that becomes religion.
Yeah, you never approach it that way, which is, I respect that. I've had many conversations with vegans that were enlightening and equally as many that are annoying.
Sure.
We all have. And it becomes one of those things where they're excited to let you know that they're a vegan. They're just, it's like a thing that they push. It's all over their stupid Twitter. It's a constant.
I battle with that a lot because a lot of the people who follow me like through social media, I'm not on Facebook by the way, but I'm on Twitter. But like a lot of people that follow me, and that are fans of mine and like hold me in high regard, they're part of that scene, and I don't dismiss that scene, but like any scene, it tends to push people away. And like a lot of these people are really passionate about what they believe, and they believe in animal rights, which I believe is a noble cause, and it's something that should be treated seriously. But they get so frustrated, and then they turn it into a them against us type of attitude, and they want to force it down people's throats, and they want to like, it turns into like a religious type of thing, and this type of thing where you're either with us or you're not. And we're going to criticize people that don't. It's like a lot of people aren't vegans because they just aren't educated. They don't understand what's going on. You end up putting more people on the defensive and pushing them away from the cause than you do educating people when you're like, oh, I'm part of some exclusive club, and like we've all got a name for it, and you have to follow these exact rules. And if you deviate from that, then you're disgusting. And oh my God, meat is disgusting, and everything. It's like that whole thing. It's like almost all of my friends eat meat. You know what I mean? Like I'm watching more and more people, but like I never ever want to make somebody feel defensive about what they do. If they have questions, I answer them. You know what I mean? And I tell them why I'm doing it. And a few of my close friends, after years and years, have just recently done the vegan thing. And they're like, dude, how come you didn't like kind of tell me about this more earlier? And I'm like, because like, you're either going to do it or you're not. I don't want to like be the guy that forces people to do things or tries to like tell them, oh, you're wrong because you're doing that. Most people are just victims of consumerism, and they're victims of misinformation, like we all are in so many ways. And the nutrition thing and like what's going on in the world with diet is no different. And so it's like, why, you know, don't force people away with your cultish ways. Educate people. And if they don't come around, then they don't come around. That's fine. We're not trying to like change the world and create an army.
You're not trying to.
Yeah.
Some people are. Some people,
that's
like,
what I'm saying.
Being a vegan becomes just like being a Mac user. And they just,
right.
Why are you using Windows still? Ugh.
It's the team mentality. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's like they've picked a side. And it's like, I feel bad about criticizing it because a lot of these people that are involved with this are really good people, and they're noble people that have taken that choice because they feel it's the right thing to do, and I'm with them on that 100%. But what's hurting it more than helping it is the attitude of it being like the like it turns into this scene, you know.
It's a moral high ground thing as well. Yeah. And so it's a chance for someone to say that they're better than you. It gets real weird. You know, lead by
and so
example.
So what happens? Yeah, people get defensive.
Lead by example.
Yeah.
Lead by example. If you enjoy your life now because of it, people will be gravitated towards that idea. They see success, they want to imitate it. That's the best way to get someone to change their diet. That's the best way to get someone to change their life. Lead by example. But when you start being a sanctimonious douchebag, when you're talking about lettuce, you can go fuck yourself.
right. It puts people on the defensive.
Yeah. Like, enough already. You're annoying. It's like anything else.
Yeah. So then they've created a divide.
Yeah.
And when you create that divide, there's the line becomes very like hard to cross again because people are like, and people already stereotype me. They're like, oh, like as soon as they hear the word vegan attached to my name, they're like, oh, great. Like, here's this douchebag, and he's just going to be talking about his diet all the time and telling me that I need to repent for my sins and everything.
Sagging like, his hipster jeans.
people don't understand. Like, I ate chicken and fish and like, meat products all through growing up and everything. Like, I'm just like everyone else. I just said to myself, I feel that this is wrong. I don't want to contribute directly to this anymore. And like, people love to argue about stuff. They want to pull up hypocrisies that, you know, like, try, like, well, you know, I guess I probably like hit some bugs on the way here in my petroleum powered car. And like, you know, like I've got like a, you know, like whatever. I've bought strawberries that were organic from Chile the other day. And like all the, you know, like the economic issues that are not economic, sorry, environmental issues that come up. And it's like, yes, you can point out hypocrisies, but I live by the set of rules that I've picked because I feel that it's right. I don't feel that I should be contributing as a consumer directly to these industries that cause nothing but suffering. And that's my thing. And like, if somebody doesn't want to do it, they don't have to. And we're still on the same ground, and I'm never going to shove it down anyone's throat.
No, you're not. And that's it's one of those things where, you know, what you're showing is what I said earlier about you, about your unwillingness to take performance-enhancing drugs or to be a part of it. You're doing it because of your principles.
Right.
We'd be a way better world if we all lived by a real set of principles. And that, I think, is one of the underlooked things that martial arts, true martial arts, provide. And I think that we should emphasize that as much as we emphasize competition success. We should emphasize the ability to enhance your development as a human being, because that's really what martial arts are spectacular for. If you never get into a fight in your whole life, you develop skills through difficult work and through, you know, building your character and responding to pressure and stress, and it makes you better at everything that you do.
Evolve, whatever that means to you, but try to evolve, move forward, you know, like build off what you're doing. And don't need to get on the steroid thing again, but I just want to say like this is one thing that I want to touch on is I've never done them, but the one time that I actually considered it, there was a point in my life that I actually was like, well, I just didn't know anyone. I was like, well, at the time I was like, if I had access to it, I might go ahead and do something like that just because I just need to like make money. And that was me responding to the lowest point of my life. That was the lowest point of my life, like as far as depression goes in the sport and everything. And I was almost willing to like go ahead and entertain the idea. And I came to that through weakness. And so all I'm saying is maybe, you know, if people are as great as they say they are, you don't need it. And I don't really don't care if the other guys are doing it. I don't care if the guy that I'm fighting is doing it and he thinks it gives him an edge and maybe giving him an edge. I'm doing this for me. I'm not doing it for my opponent, and I'm not doing it for the sport.
What do you think about the future of performance-enhancing drugs? Because the real issue to me is not things that you introduce to your body, but rather what you do to change the way your body behaves and reacts. When you talk about like gene therapy, and when you talk about the improvements in our understanding of genetics and certain switches and different mechanisms inside the body that trigger muscular development, yeah. recuperation, and all that stuff is going to eventually be manipulated.
Well,
you know, what happens to mixed martial arts when that happens?
Well, people are sheep, and you know, they for the most part they really are. And so whatever is considered, whatever is established as the moral norm will be okay. Like right now, like we're in a situation where everybody's like mad, like, oh, Mark McGwire, and mad at Barry Bonds, and mad at these players for doing all this stuff. But if somehow they're able to legitimize a different type of performance enhancing scenario like what you're talking about, like mm-hmm. gene therapy or whatever, like if they're able to legitimize that socially, like on an ethical way, then as long as the public thinks it's okay, then everybody will start doing it, I think. You know what I mean? It all depends on – and right now, the public, for the most part, seems like they feel like it's wrong to go ahead and agree to not take steroids and then, like, lie about it and then go and do it. And I think that's that's a good way of thinking about it.
I think they also realize in some sports is no matter what, you're getting it. Football is one of them. When you look at the size of those guys, you go, what is going on?
Yeah.
What has changed so radically that people are that enormous?
Yeah,
What's going on there? Well, who knows? Is it hormones in the meat? You know, what is it?
Yeah.
It seems like there's certain heights of size and strength that you can't reach without supplements.
Yeah.
It's to me, it's a weird thing because this is a mere blip in human development. I mean, if you go back just 100 years ago, there was nothing. There was nothing you could do. You ate good food, and that's it. When 100 years is the tiniest amount of time you can even measure when you start talking about the universe.
Yeah.
100 years is a joke. You know, I mean, as far as like change and the radical change in what we've been able to do and manipulate the human body, when you watch like Ray Kurzweil, the singular, do you know his movie about the singularity? What is it? What is Ray Kurzweil? Transcendent Man. And it's all about the technological singularity that, like, avoid it whether or not you want to avoid it. Like, there's people that are like, you know what? I just read books. I don't go on the internet. I don't even have an email. That's all good, but you're not going to stop it. It's swarming around you, whether you accept it or not. And I kind of have the feeling that that applies to all aspects of technology improvement and innovation, including the manipulation of the human body. And it's going to be really strange when they start figuring out a way to turn virtually every person you see into a Vitali Klitschko, into a giant super athlete. I mean, we're going to be able to do very strange things and manipulate the body in very weird ways in the future.
Yeah, if it's profitable, you know what I mean? That's all it comes down to. If it can create entertainment for the people paying for it,
change life as we know it. If the organic body ceases to become finite, if the organic body is a renewable thing that you can constantly replace limbs on and constantly fix organs and literally we change the whole idea about having a lifespan.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as simple as cheating in MMA. It's as simple as like we're going to transcend the boundaries of our biological nature. And that's something where MMA is sort of caught up in the periphery of that, like the improvements that we've been able to do to sports science. And, you know, I love that term, sports science. I mean, it's basically just the body, right? How it's about science, biological science. The improvements that we've made just in understanding diet, nutrition, supplementation, and training, all that is pretty substantial.
Yeah.
But it's nothing compared to what they're going to do once they introduce genetics and all of a sudden you're a lion, you know? I mean, we're going to have a weird world.
Yeah, it's that's interesting too because, like evolution has happened a lot. I think if I'm correct, through like mutations that happen, you know, like on a hormone level or a cellular level within people. And if that mutation happens to be advantageous to have in the current environment, then that moves on, mm-hmm. right? You know, rather than like the person adapting to the environment, it's like here's a chance, you know, here's a mutation, it's just a little bit different, you know, and so we're at the point where we're actually able to manipulate that manually, or we're going to, and that's just
fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and as strange as it is, I don't feel like it's completely unnatural. You know what I mean? Like it is unnatural, like in a primal way, but like I feel like that's just what we're kind of rolling into, you know, as a species.
I completely agree.
Yeah,
everything's natural, even pollution.
It's
a natural aspect. I mean, of the ability to control their environment.
We're just displacing stuff.
Yeah, and it's also the lack of discipline, the ability to have the ability to say, let's move this over there, without you ever having to figure out how to move this over there. You're just a guy with a crane.
Right.
And let's dig a hole and throw it in there. How can you dig that hole so efficiently? Well, some brilliant person figured out how to make this monstrous machine that moves ground very easily. And you come along with very little responsibility for that and very little. It's like winning the lottery. Yeah. Like all of a sudden you have this money and the money goes away. You have power you haven't earned. You haven't developed the character to control that.
It's a strange situation that we're in now with all this technology. It's like how many people actually know how to engineer the iPhone, you know, really like all these things that we're using, like the knowledge of it is so specific that we don't know. And that's why like the software guy knows nothing about what the hardware guy knows and vice versa. And lots of times neither one of those guys can change a tire, and they sure as hell can't identify what plants are poisonous and what plants are edible in the wild. So it's like, We're on a very strange path, and I don't want to like necessarily judge it or criticize it as being like completely negative and evil or wonderful and beautiful. It's like it just is what it is, and people are doing what they're doing. I personally feel like more people should get in touch with the actual earth, which is, you know, we're products of the earth. This is our cradle. You know what I mean? This is like where we're born into, and I feel like people should get in touch with the essence of the earth more and just be like understand the earth.
But don't go close to bears and take pictures of them, you motherfuckers. There is a reason why they have a 50-yard rule when you go to Yellowstone. Some asshole got eaten recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm sure he's not an asshole. Sure. He fucked up. I shouldn't call him an asshole. He probably has a lot of friends that miss him. I apologize for that. But yeah, homeboy took pictures of a bear for 8 minutes before it ate him.
Oh,
he's got
man.
8 minutes of photos.
Oh man!
Yeah, he fucked up.
Wow.
Yeah, you can't. You gotta be really respectful of nature. You gotta really understand that there's a food chain going on. You're lucky. You don't have a real place in it, a natural place where they consistently hunt you.
Sure.
But you go out there. That's you're going out into the wild.
What I mean by like being in touch with the earth isn't necessarily like going out and trying to, you know, live with the actual animals. I mean,
oh, like, no, I'm not saying that either. This guy wasn't living with him. He was just taking pictures.
Well, like expose yourself to, I mean, like,
understand it.
Yeah. Understand it and just understand how it works. And it would be great if people understood. I mean, look at this way. Like, we're supposed to be these amazingly evolved people and we're like superior than everything else on the earth. Okay, well, why is it that every single other species living on the planet, you can, you know, unless it's in a completely alien environment, like a penguin in the desert, most of the time you set it out in the wild. You take a deer and you set it out in the wild, it's going to be all right unless it gets hit by a car, killed by a person. It knows what plants to eat, what plants not to eat. It knows where to go to get water. It knows how to go after water. We don't know anything. You take like a person, even that is like an outdoorsman, and put them in the wild, and there's a chance that they're not going to survive.
If you ever watch Survivor, man, you know. Yeah. it's fucking hard just to be outside.
Of course.
Just to be outside for a few days is hard.
And think about the hypothetical scenario. I'm not trying to get all like paranoid doomsday or anything like that.
Oh, here comes,
man. I'm just saying, if it, you know, how many people, and obviously we're going to be if that happened, we're going to be dealing with the urban environment and what's left of it in many ways.
A battlefield.
But yeah, it's like if you are in the wilderness, like how are you going to survive? Are you going to be able to make a run for the wilderness? I think most people would just end up staying in an urban environment, even if it's all rubble, and just trying to get together and
grow some
make
food.
Something happen in that way, because I don't think that people are going to be able to live in the wild.
I want to live off the land. I think that would be the most romantic thing ever. Have a house by a lake, eat fish, grow your own vegetables, go hunting.
Homesteading.
It's the way to go. It just takes too much goddamn time. You want to write comedy and go to jiu-jitsu class?
Well, yeah, you gotta hunt. Yeah, you can't combine that with the format.
Regular life.
Yeah, that we're living in now. You'd have to take a step away from that. And that seems, maybe it's just a romantic idea to me. Maybe it's like naive to think this way. But I would like to step off of the grid at some point in my life and live my life that way. You know, for the remainder of my years. You know, I don't know if it'll ever happen. It might be just, you know, a pure fantasy. But if I'm able to, I think I would learn a whole lot more about myself and about the earth than I would in any other way. And I would learn about a lot more about the essence of being a human being, rather than just, you know, waking up and doing the same thing every day, you know, that we do in society nowadays.
But have you ever thought about doing your own podcast, dude?
I have, yeah. Actually,
why don't you do that?
Yeah, I want to. I just don't have, I don't know, like, I'm not good with, I don't know, like, I'd have to set the whole thing up, like, where to host it, and, like, you know, like all the technological things, I have to learn about all them, and I take the technology pretty well, but I have to research it, and I
you
just
could do it. Trust me, all my retarded friends do it. You could do it.
Yeah,
everyone
I
know has a podcast.
I saw,
now.
Yeah, Ari had the little,
recorder,
it? The Zoom,
Tascam,
Zoom
yeah,
thing. Yeah,
good.
Yeah, so I actually got one of those and mics. I just don't. I just have to start organizing it
figure
and then
it out.
Figure out where to host it and how to put it on iTunes and all that stuff.
Play around with it, dude. You could do it, and you got a lot of shit to say about things. I think there's only so much you can express yourself when you're on The Ultimate Fighter, or when you're, you know, in post-fight interviews. You know, I mean, it's like there's not that much time where people get a chance to sit down and get to know you. But I think you're an admirable example for young men as far as like sticking to your principles, as far as having a code that you live your life by, which I think is something that's really absent in a lot of people in this life. You know, you're another example of a guy who's gone through a lot of adverse situations and developed great character and resolve because of that, man. So
Thanks,
was a great
man.
Podcast. I really enjoyed it. And
I appreciate it, man.
And I think people are going to enjoy this, too. They're going to get a different sense of who you are. And, you know, we all need to hear these kind of stories about turning your life around, about developing, you know, your character. I mean, these are all like really important stories for people to hear. They're empowering, and I think they allow us to learn things without having to go through your experience. We can learn from your interpretations of your experience, and if we're presented with similar problems or similar scenarios in our life, we can learn. We can learn from what you learned and what the people before you who expressed themselves that you learned from their experiences as well. It's very important, man, and so thanks a lot for doing this.
Yeah, man. Thanks
for
having
me. We're
going
to do this
again.
And I'm so sorry I fucked
up
before. But according to Twitter, everybody's enjoying the shit out of this. So it's all legit now.
Yeah.
And it will be saved on Twitter. And if people want to get in touch with Mac, you can get him on Twitter. It's Mac Danzig MMA. Whoever you are, you dirty bitch that has Mac Danzig, give it up to the man. You know that's his name. Why are you playing games, man? What are you doing? Your name ain't Mac Danzig, son. There's a few real live Joe Rogans out there. It's not that unusual. And I'm sorry if you have to take a lot of shit because of me. It's not my fault. But Mac Danzig MMA on Twitter. Tonight at the Ice House Comedy Club, again, it is a crazy fucking stupid packed show with Joey Diaz, Greg Fitzsimmons, Duncan Trussell, Ari Shaffir, Brian Redban, Doug Benson. Did I mention anybody? Not? Did I say Joey Diaz?
Ari?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And me, you fucks. It's going to be incredible. And we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to be back with Billy Corbin. Billy Corbin is the director of Cocaine Cowboys, and he will be joined by Mad Flavor, cocksucker, who's going to lay it down and let you know what the fuck was really going on in Miami in the 70s, Joe Rogan. The 70s. Very, very intense conversation I had with him about this yesterday. Thanks to onnit.com. Go to onnit.com and get yourself some Alpha Brain, you dirty bitch. Improve the way your brain functions, son. Don't snort it off your keyboard, though. I don't think that shit's recommended.
That really, really fucked me up. Like, I almost had to leave because that, like, it started really, it felt like it was fucking
You really
head.
Did snort it?
No, I inhaled it through that big straw, like, so it's all this powder in my mouth. And whatever's in that, like, really made me feel fucked up. Like, I was really fucked up for the...
Oh, you're such a unique person. Go to onnit.com, use the code name Rogan, save yourself 10% off any supplements, and go to Death Squad. Get yourself some delicious Death Squad stickers, some yummy Death Squad t-shirts, and by the way, it supports the Death Squad Podcast Network, which is the only place to hear the Ice House Chronicles, which is the one that we do from the Ice House with all these badass comedians. All right, you freaks, we'll see you in a little bit. Thank you very much, and we'll be back.